Every clock in this building has a different time?
It's always been.
But my computer says 8.
It says 8, all right. The Senate Interim Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming, gentlemen. It's nice to see you here today. We are continuing our discussion today on some issues related to safety and child welfare and children's residential care. You'll remember we had a pretty lively hearing in September, and today we have some folks from the department here and the governor to talk to us about what has unfolded since we were last here, some updates on the Give Us This Day situation, and then some proposals moving forward for how we can make care safer for all kids across the state. So to kick us off this morning, we have our new interim director of the Oregon Department of Human Services, Clyde Seike, and our governor, Kate Brown. And I will open the informational meeting on new directions for the Oregon Department of Human Services. Welcome, and thank you both very much for taking the time to come today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you this morning. For the record, Kate Brown, serving as Oregon's governor. I appreciate the opportunity to make some brief comments before turning things over to Clyde Seike, interim director at the Department of Human Services. I'm here today because, like you, I care deeply about the safety of vulnerable children in our foster care system. We must provide our children with safe and caring environments that allow them to thrive. It is our duty. It's also our duty to hold agencies accountable and ensure that they use state resources prudently. These are commitments that we as state leaders have made and values we share in both chambers and in both sides of the aisle. Recent information has come to light that calls into question Oregon's foster care services and state agency accountability. This is absolutely unacceptable. I've already taken steps to find out what has happened and address the issues, and I'd like to give a quick overview of things where they currently stand. As you know, on November 4th, I asked Clyde Seike to step in as interim director of the Department of Human Services and lead the agency until a successor can be named. A national search is underway. I had appointed Clyde as the state's chief operating officer a few months ago, and I'm grateful to have such an experienced and respected state's manager to turn to in these circumstances. I have confidence in his ability to maintain stability in the agency while facilitating the resolution to these difficult issues. I've directed Clyde to engage an external contractor to conduct an independent assessment of the DHS foster care system. This assessment will include adequacy of cultural competence in our system, abuse and neglect investigations in licensed care, communications and accountability mechanisms within the agency, and financial stability and sufficiency of foster care providers. The contractor will provide me and you with a report that includes recommendations for necessary changes. To provide feedback and advice along the way, I will name by the end of this week an advisory committee comprised of legislators, representatives of providers, and community stakeholder groups. The group will serve as both a sounding board for the external reviewer throughout the process, as well as a sounding board during the implementation phase. Clyde will also appoint by the end of this week an internal resource group that will supply agency data and information and provide any needed assistance to the reviewer. I've requested weekly reports on the progress of this comprehensive assessment, which upon completion may result in legislation. Any recommendations that are actionable without legislation will be considered immediately. I will not hesitate to use my pen and my executive power. During the interim, between the 2005 and 2007 legislative sessions, I made a decision to go back to practice law in the foster care system. During that time, we put together a working group. Senator Cruz, you were part of that working group. And I think we were looking to find a silver bullet that would fix this system. We were able to pass a package of bills that made substantial improvements to the system. However, there is still much more work to be done, and I know, of course, that there's no silver bullet or easy solutions. This will take time and committed attention, as well as resources. It has mine, and I know it has yours. Thank you. I appreciate specifically the attention and leadership of Senator Gelser. She's worked very closely with DHS staff and my staff to address the concerns that have been raised. I look forward to continuing our collaborative work to make foster care a safe haven for all of our Oregon children in the system. I appreciate the opportunity to share my remarks. I'm happy to take a few moments to answer questions before I turn it over to Mr. Psyche.
Thank you so much, Thank Governor. You. And I've really appreciated your very close attention to this from the very first day. Are there questions for the Governor? Senator Cruz.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. Governor, not so much questions. You and I have been involved in this for a very long time now, and I really appreciate the fact that you have a task force on the legal side of this issue, but it all dovetails together, and we know that. I just wanted to point out that Senator Shields has been having a series of town halls around the state focused on foster parents, and I attended one last week that he had in Central Point, and that's another piece of this. So we just need to make sure that we're comprehensive in our look, and we also need to make sure that when we have bad actors, we don't paint everybody with that same brush.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, thank you. Yes, I'm certainly aware of the Senate Bill 222 task force. We hope that there will be some overlap between that particular task force and our advisory committee. I appreciate Senator Shields' leadership. I know he has personal experience with foster parenting, and I know he's not the only member of the Oregon legislature. It's certainly one of the toughest jobs that we have, and I appreciate both members in the legislature as well as other folks out there who are willing to step up to the plate and be foster parents. It's a really challenging job.
Thank you. Any further questions for the governor? Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Senator Gelser. Governor, thank you so much for being here. Of course, I want to just follow up with what Senator Cruz said regarding painting everyone with the same brush, because I know that we actually underfund some of our providers, and that has been a huge issue every time. And when you have some of these providers working on a shoestring, and then we're going to, you know, ask for more and more for them to do, I'm hoping that we can find dollars that can make sure that these providers can do a very safe and quality-oriented program.
Madam Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, yes, and frankly, it's not only the providers that have been, shall we say, minimally funded in terms of the services they provide. As an attorney, former attorney practicing in the system, I will just share with you that in my year and a half time frame that I practiced, I practiced with an organization that I believe provides the best legal services for children in the state. And I was working half time. On my caseload, I had 90 children. So that was an example of the caseloads that attorneys are carrying. And then you may recall that the Secretary of State's office did an audit specifically looking at caseworkers. It was in 2012 or 2013, but our caseworkers as well have very high caseloads. I suspect since that audit was completed, there has been, I hope, some improvement in terms of caseworkers, but there is still more work to be done, and resources are an issue, and we need to address that as well.
Thank you. Any Senator
Dimbro? Thanks, Madam Chair. Governor, just following up on the comment about providers, so what do you see as the role of providers, of the provider community, in advising you on this matter and coming up with a sense of best practices and how the organizations can sort of self-police and, you know, help self-monitor and perhaps keep us from going down this road again.
Madam Chair, Senator Dambro, in terms of providers, I see them as one voice in terms of the advisory committee. I think there need to be a number of voices at the table in terms of both improving communication at the department, enhancing our licensing process. Senator Gelser has specifically called for additional staff in that arena. I think the providers add both the experience and expertise that I think needs to be at the table. I also think it's important that we have some national perspective in terms of what are best practices out there. So I think it's very important that they be at the table. I think obviously they're critical component to the system, but I think there also needs to be other folks at the table as well.
Any further questions? No, thank you very much. Thank you for the complexity. We talked a little bit about the representation on that task force. I think that goes to the question that Senator Dimbro just asked as well, and it certainly is a collaborative process to move forward and make things safer for kids. And I think the legislature has a role, as many people have mentioned, in appropriately resourcing these activities and looking across the country to see how other states have addressed this. Just as there's not a magic bullet solution, I haven't found a state that has figured out how to do this appropriately. I think too often child welfare issues really do fall to the bottom of the list in terms of priorities for investment, whether that is in core central office staff or those frontline workers or the foster care parents. And we've got to find a way to change that. And it would be wonderful if Oregon could be the state that elevated this issue.
I look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you. Welcome, Clyde.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, for the record, and members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, and I'm the interim director of the Department of Human Services. This is day five on the job, and having spent some time in the department previously, I've been telling folks it's sort of like deja vu all over again, and it's really amazing how it all kind of comes rushing back to you once you are at the department. So when the governor asked me to step in as the interim director, she made it very clear to me that recent events at the department were unacceptable and that my top priority was to ensure that children and other Oregonians in our care are safe and getting the services that they deserve. There are a lot of committed and dedicated staff at DHS, and we ask them to do some of the toughest jobs in state government. And it's incumbent on us to provide them with the tools and the resources they need to perform these jobs. As the governor mentioned, we are working diligently to bring a contractor on board to provide us with an independent review and assessment on ways we can improve our processes and systems. However, in my short time there, there are a couple areas where I think we can begin to work on immediately and begin to make improvements. The two areas that I've identified are around some of our processes and systems, and also issues around the culture in the agency and how we deal with issues. So let me give you just a couple quick examples of each of these areas. So on the process and system side, we have a lot of different parts of the department that are engaged and involved with our paid providers. We have offices that handle licensing and abuse investigation. We have the child welfare field staff who visit and monitor these facilities. We have our financial staff who are responsible for monitoring the financial stability of the providers. And then most importantly of all, we have the leadership of the department who are ultimately responsible for the safety and the care of the children that we have custody of. One of the first things I ask people is whether or not we had a systematic way that when any one of these entities identifies a provider that is having some issues or some problems, Whether or not we had a systematic way for all the people who have responsibility for the system to get together and vet issues and talk about, share information and talk about ways we can either help the provider improve or, if necessary, to take corrective action. And I was told, or what I found, is that if communication happens, it's more by accident than design. And so one of the first things we have to do is to make sure that every part of our department that helps to monitor and maintain the system has a process in which we can get together and vet issues, share information, and make sure that we're supporting providers or taking corrective action if that's necessary. The other piece that I've noticed, or the other part that I think we can immediately begin to take action on, is around part of the cultural practice of the agency, and it's around the issues of communication and transparency. So we will always guard and respect the confidentiality of our children and our clients, but I've come to the conclusion that if we, the department, is responsible in trying to solve whatever issues we have by ourselves, we are not going to be successful. We have to engage a wide range of people, legislature, stakeholders, providers, advocates. And that's the only way we are going to be able to address the issues and find solutions that are going to help us improve the system. So the independent review that the Governor commissioned is an important first step in improving processes and systems in the agency, but I would submit to you that it's only the first step. As an agency, we have to commit to an ongoing process of monitoring and improving systems and processes that serve the citizens of the state of Oregon. This commitment is the only way we can hope to provide the best service possible and ensure the safety of our foster children. We must do better. The children of Oregon deserve no less. So I want to take the opportunity to express my appreciation for the support and leadership that Senator Gelser is providing, and we look forward to working with all of you as we move forward. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Clyde. Other questions for Clyde? Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Welcome aboard, Clyde. I don't envy you at all. DHS is such an important part of our system, and we as a state are mandated in our Constitution that we are the ones who take care of the most vulnerable.
Right.
And yet, because lives are getting more complicated, there's obviously more kids in the foster care system, and yet we're not funding them at the level that we should. And so I definitely want to put on the record that, at least from my point of view, that, yes, I would love to see changes. I would love to see caseloads go down. But I also want to have funding be adequate so that the providers get their entry-level training at some of our providers and then move on to another job that pays more. And we know that exists in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Other comments or questions?
Yep.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, sir, and welcome to the morass, if you will. A couple questions for you.
Sure.
You're going to hire an outside contractor to look at this, but yet we've heard testimony here today and comments from the dais here that states everywhere can't figure this out. So if we hire an outside contractor, how do we know that this outside contractor can figure it out? Because if they could, they would fix every state.
Right. Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, that's a great question. I think several people have made the comment that there is really no silver bullet, and I would totally agree with that. It's a very complex issue. What my approach is going to be is that while no state has completely figured out how to deal with some of the issues we're facing, There are states that have best practices and very good systems in place for particular parts of the system. And so that's something that I'm hoping to get in the recommendations for the contractor. And one of the other things, in I know this may be scary to some people, but my experience in state government is that we keep trying to solve problems we've had on an ongoing basis using the same solutions over and over again. And I really believe that we have to look at a different approach, and we have to try some different things in order to improve the system. I mean, you know, there's, I think, the classic definition, Albert Einstein's insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And I think to some extent that's what we've been doing. And so it really is going to be a matter of best practices and then sitting back and saying, you know, that's something we haven't tried again, and we may want to try that because it may give us the result that we haven't been able to achieve so far.
I heard you make a statement that was rather concerning to me, but I thank you for what you're doing. It didn't seem like there was any interdepartment communication. And so my question to you is, you've spotted this in your first 5 days. My point is, why hasn't anyone else seen this earlier? But the other point I'm getting to is, when you're not there, when someone else comes in, how do you, because I like the attitude you have, and I like the goals that you're looking for and the path you're going down, how can we be assured that the new agency director will see those same things the way you do and figure them out to get to this communication gap?
Sure. Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, so in my real job, I'm the COO and Director of Administrative Services, and so I don't plan on, once we hire a new person and I move out of the role, to divorce myself from DHS. I think, as Senator Monis Anderson pointed out, it's such a critical agency, and we deal with some of the most vulnerable people. I have to stay connected, and I want to see some of the things that I start carry forward. And so I will be working very closely with the new director to make sure that, and here's kind of what I think we need to do. We need to put systems and processes in place that are sustainable, so it doesn't really matter who the people are. And if people change, we've made the system or the process so much of the culture that it's going to carry on no matter who. If we have to change some of the people in the organization and some
kind
of the
like
leadership.
What we have now, a culture that carries on but doesn't get the job done.
Right, which we need to change.
Thank you.
So, Senator Chair Gelser, if
yes.
I can just make one
of
comment.
Course.
And I think it's been brought up in a way by several members of the committee. We have providers in our system who do a very, very good job. They do a very tough job with some very tough children, with a limited number of resources, and I recognize that. And I think the important part of this process is to make sure that those providers are part of the process and have a voice and help inform whatever we're going to do to move forward. And I will commit to all of you that I will work with them and include them in the process.
And I absolutely agree with you. It's important not to paint everybody with the same brush. And I agree with everything that's been said here about lack of resource and the importance of appropriately resourcing things. But I also think it's important, as we move into the next part of the agenda, to talk about some of the legislative action we need to take in February, that the issues that we are facing right now that brought all of this to the surface was not an issue of lack of funding. It was an issue where there was a bad actor. There were absolutely inexcusable things happening to children in our care, and the state either couldn't or didn't have the tools available to it in order to act quickly. And I think in discussions with your staff, it's clear that that's not the only time that there haven't been the tools available to act when people within your agency have known kids are not well, and they don't have the statutory authority to immediately restrict admissions or to move kids to a safer place. Those are things that that has nothing to do with adding new regulations to providers. That means holding accountable those those that are not good actors and that are not following the regulations that are already in place. So as we talk about these other things, I don't want us to allow ourselves to feel better by stepping back from something that was a failure of all of us, and that the consequence was kids that deserved a lot better, sure, regardless of the funding or how difficult their circumstances were.
Can I have a question?
I think Senator Dimbrough was in the queue first, and I'll bring you back in.
Thank you. Director Psyche, thank you for taking on this task. I'm very pleased that you have. Could you just review the timeline that we're looking at for the different steps, you know, in terms of forming the advisory committee, hiring the outside consultant, et cetera, et cetera?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson. So the governor had discussions over the weekend with the president and the speaker. And so we've she's going to be reaching out to members from the legislature who will be part of the committee. We also, over the weekend, developed a list of organizations or entities, provider groups, communities of color, the tribes, maybe Secretary of State, and we're going to be reaching out to all of them. So hopefully by the end of the week, we'll have firmed up the kind of advisory oversight committee pretty quickly. I have brought over someone with me from the Department of Administrative Services, Janine Beatrice, to serve as the project manager. Her number one priority is identifying potential contractors, and she'll be working with the DAS Procurement Office to get someone on board. And I'm hoping that by the end of the week, we'll have a short list of people that we will talk to. We've already talked to DAS Procurement, and we're going to do an emergency procurement, and we'll bring the person on board as quickly as we can. And as soon as we get those two things firmed up, then we will convene the first meeting of the advisory committee just to kind of set the context and get input and direction from them as we negotiate the contract.
Mm-hmm. And just to follow up, and, sure. So what do you see as the timeline for the consultant's work?
You know,
presumably you'll put that into the RFP or?
We will. And the governor and I, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Dimbrough, the governor and I talked about that yesterday. Maybe initially we're thinking in the time frame of about 4 or 5 months, but just. I guess one of the things I want to share with the committee is that we will learn things as we go along in the process. And if they make a recommendation or point something out that we can deal with right away, we're not going to wait for the report to be finalized to start to implement some of the changes that they are recommending or pointing out to us. We can't wait.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Yes. In the interim, in a chain of command in any organization, people at the bottom try to filter things to the top. Since we have such a problematic situation here, will you have an open door policy so that the lowest person can walk into your door and say, hey, boss, I think this is going awry?
Right. Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, throughout my career in state government, that's kind of been my policy. And quite honestly, the people who have kind of been the people who manage my calendar and support me, I kind of drive them crazy because they, you know, have a tendency to want to schedule your day out and have a very planned day for you. I will stop to talk to anybody anytime about anything. Some of the best feedback I've got are in the hallways or in the restroom or the cafeteria. And so I definitely, and one of kind of the basic things I've learned is that the higher up you go in an organization, it seems that the people you interact with and talk to, the scope seems to narrow the higher you move up in an organization. And I think that's actually a very dangerous thing. And you really need to have input and take the pulse of the organization from the very top and at every layer if you want to be an effective director.
Follow
it. That's kind of like my dad's adage, who always told me that you know the best of your business when you always have your hands dirty. because you're down there with the workers and you know what they do and what they see, and they can pass it on to you. I like that attitude, and I hope you carry it forward. My only concern is from Senator Embro when you say 4 to 5 months, that'll put us beyond February, and we won't have an opportunity to put in legislation, so it'll be a long time before we can fix this.
Right. Well, I think Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Gelser has done a very good job of working with our staff to outline some changes that we could bring to the legislature in February, changes that I think our staff actually are very excited about, because it'll give them the authority to be able to do their jobs better. And you know, again, we're not going to wait till the report is finalized to start to take action. Anything we learn along the way that's actionable, we're going to move on it right away.
I thank you for your attitude, and I thank you for taking this project on.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Any one? Senator Montesanderson.
Thank you, Senator Gelser. You talked about communications and transparency, but one of the concerns is inspections and follow-up and enforcement, and if the staff is adequately trained to really do an adequate inspection so that we can find or at least be aware of some of the problems, rather than trying to wait for a staff member to resign and go somewhere else and then come forward. So in the omnibus bill or whatever, is there going to be something about inspections? And of course that will take resources, but still there needs to be an adequate inspection system.
Right, agreed. And Senator Gelser, I don't know if you want to speak to
yes,
that.
that's part of it, and when we get to the next part of the agenda, we'll talk about it.
Okay.
Anything further? No, Clyde, I just want to thank you for just diving in feet first. I know your first day was a week ago today. I had the opportunity to spend 2 hours with you the Friday before you started work, so thank you for that. And, you know, as we move into the next piece, all of your staff, Lois and Marie and Donna and others, I know have put an extraordinary amount of time in the last few weeks, gathering a lot of information, going back to look at data that's hard to look at, and have really mm-hmm. done so in a way to try to come up with solutions to keep kids safer faster. And I know that everyone at the department wants kids to be safe and have chosen careers that are committed to doing that, and I'm very grateful to the time and effort that everybody's put into this.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. All right, so I'm going to close the new directions for DHS and open the informational hearing on committee bill proposals. So I'm going to go through this memo that we have packets for everyone.
Yes? Madam Chair, members of the committee, everything is posted on OLIS except the document I'm going to supplement right now.
Can people have that physical copy that I brought for them too, please? Thanks. So I gave to Cheyenne a memo, and hopefully that will be coming soon, and there should be extra copies to put into the back. And this is an outline of two bills that would go into the February session. The long document is not as long as it seems, and kind of identifies solutions to some of the policy issues that have come up in the discussions with the Department of Human Services and the Department of Justice.
Before
providers
we go,
centers.
I'd like to follow, and I have forgotten now how to get onto OLIS from this computer.
Can we give people the hard copies?
Okay.
We'll just wait until we've got the hard copies.
I like hard copies, too.
I know.
So you can tear them up.
You mean like this one?
I like paper.
Like that one, yes. But it's been edited since I sent it to you. Thank you.
Thank you. You edited this one?
A little bit, yeah. So the proposals here, and after we talk about this, we'll have staff kind of come up and talk about some of the the problems and strengths of some of these proposals and where they come from. But before we get into the elements of this omnibus bill, there would be a second bill, and this goes to the discussion that Senator Montes Anderson raised a moment ago. I was surprised to learn that we have only 3 licensing staff to oversee 203 children's programs, which may have, each of those may have more than a single site. So if you think about that idea of expecting these licensors to be able to go out and do these irregular interval, unannounced visits into these programs and license fast enough to address the capacity, that is an issue. So we will have a bill to expand the position authority for licensing. We've talked with the governor about this and the presiding officers. It looks like that is resource that we will be able to shake loose. The other thing that was a surprise is that for kids licensing, it's the only program that DHS licenses that has no licensing fee structure that goes along with it. So there is no application fee when you apply for a license. In February, fee bills are very difficult, and it's too soon to do that. But that bill would include a direction to have a collaborative look with the providers at what is an appropriate fee structure to support a robust licensing system. And the thing to remember about that licensing system, it's not just compliance, like we're going to ding you for not following this rule. It's also technical assistance, and it's the ability to process applications quickly, which is important not just for those providers but for the system, where we really do have a lack of capacity to meet kids. So that increased capacity would help with all of those pieces.
Chief Gelser, when you say provide licenses quickly, how would that entail an in-depth investigation as to the person you're going to give the license to?
So
quick, could you define quickly?
So quickly would mean at a more rapid pace than currently. If you have 3 people who I do believe are working hard to do a thorough job on each license, to do that job well, it will go faster for the number of licenses that are coming in if we have more feet on the ground to be able to do that. And that's a problem if you have a provider that is willing, ready, and qualified to provide for vulnerable kids, and we can't get them set up to provide those services just because it takes so long to get through that licensing process because we have an inadequate number of people working in licensing. So yeah, the intent isn't to do a cursory glance. It's to strengthen the quality of care.
Well, my only concern is when you say qualified, how have we determined they're qualified?
We'll get to that.
Have we investigated them thoroughly, and how long does that investigation take?
They will, and I think Donna will come up and talk a little bit about that. But we have incredibly robust rules for providers. I don't know that we need any new rules for providers that they need to comply with. There's hundreds of them. And licensing goes through and evaluates these programs on hundreds of individual rules before they come out. That may be something we want to look at moving forward. Do we need all of those that are there? Are some of them redundant? Could we find some efficiency? But I do not believe that we lack regulation for providers.
Madam Chair, we may have regulation that's way more complicated than it needs to be, and streamlining may be appropriate. But I also wanted to say that one of the things Senator Shields has been focusing on in his meetings with foster parents is licensure, and he's getting a lot of feedback on that. So I think connecting with him will probably be helpful on this.
Sounds great. All right. So that is kind of a separate piece looking at that licensing capacity. But moving into the elements of the bill, one of the things that we learned is that, and a question that many of us asked either in the hearing or in the months after that, how could all these things be happening and kids still continue to be placed there? The issue is what it takes for the agency to be able to make a change to a license or put a condition on a license. And what I've learned would be helpful is to put in statute that the department actually has at their disposal a variety of tools which they can select to use at the appropriate time that would range from putting conditions on a license, which might include, hey, you're having a problem right now, we're going to close you to admissions while we fix it, to a suspension, to a complete revocation of license. In other licensing areas, there is this broader range of options, but in kids programs, it's either you have a license or you don't have a license. And to revoke a license is a very, very high, and it should be a relatively high bar, but that creates a barrier to the department to address issues. And I think one of the places that you can see that, Donna Ketty did some really great work going back and looking at all providers and looking at, there's a radar list that's kept of providers that are problems. It looks like this at the top. It's got a letter, and it's also in OLIS. But for the last 36 months, Give Us This Day, for example, was on that radar list for 26 of those months where the department knew that was a problem. There's another provider out there, I don't know who it is, that's been on the list even longer than Give Us This Day. But licensing still did not have the tools that it needed to be able to make a change in the license. So what you see kind of bulleted out in this licensing set of the bill are a whole series of issues that could allow the department to access that range of issues to take action on a license. That is not a change to what's required to providers. That's just clarifying the authority that the department has. One of the other issues that came up was that in a licensed child care provider that's doing foster care licensing, they're recruiting and overseeing foster parents. DHS is not licensing those foster care parents, so there's no oversight when they're coming through that organization. We are one of the only states that does that. And you'll see in the letter from the Alliance of Children's Programs that they too think that it would make sense, and that document's in OLIS, to have a dual certification, that you have to meet the standards of the state and that provider to do that. And in doing that, we have to look at the licensing capacity so that it's not slow to issue those licenses. So that's in here. The issue of foster care being a for-profit enterprise doesn't make a whole lot of sense given the information that's in that system. So this would clarify that moving forward to do a placement for foster care, that would be a nonprofit organization. There are a couple that are currently serving kids. We would grandfather those in, and you have a list of those in OLIS as well.
Madam Chair, the distinction between nonprofit and for-profit is a very blurry one. We know that. If you have a facility and you have multiple kids, you need to be able to make a living at that.
Correct. Okay. It's by the corporation status, not that people won't be paid. It's you would be incorporated as a nonprofit organization.
Okay. But that there's a very blurry line between profit and nonprofit. So.
Okay. So all of the next bullets are all around that ability to revoke a license with safety, with the financial issues that you raised last time, Senator Olson, clarifying that payments to providers need to be made by an electronic funds transfer rather than through a paper check. That became an issue in this situation that we recently saw. That would be one of the changes for the providers. In looking at one of the other issues that came up is that the department has to license an organization that is found to be substantially compliant with all of those rules that are out there. There are hundreds of them. And what that definition of substantially compliant is a little bit unclear. So right now, some could argue that if there are, and I'll make a number, if there are 200 regulations and you're compliant 150 of them, you're substantially compliant regardless of what those 50 are, that you are losing kids or you're not feeding them. So this would make clear two things, that you have to be compliant in at least 90% of the area, and that you'd have 45 days to fix those on your relicensure, because everybody's fully compliant when they're initially licensed, but that there are certain areas related to kids and family rights, child abuse reporting, behavior management, resident furnishings and personal items, food, safety, medication, and minimum staffing that you always have to be in compliance with. You cannot be substantially compliant if you are not meeting the requirements in those areas.
Madam Chair, if I may interject.
Mm-hmm.
A couple notes that I had in some of your bullets where it says if the department finds the financial health of the organization impacts child safety and or stability, it may be grounds for denial. I really think that should be shall be grounds for denial, because if they are impacting child safety and stability, you should deny them their license. You shouldn't give the opportunity to say, which is apparently what we did with Give Us This Day, well, we can, but we're not going to. Shouldn't that be stronger worded to say you shall deny them if they're impacting child safety?
And I think that's a question we can ask of DHS when they come back. We kind of went back and forth with that may and shall. The issue that we have to be careful of, the issue with Give Us This Day was incredibly extreme. There could be another circumstance where there's a provider that's been a great provider for a long time, and they go through a period where they've had a new executive director that's difficult or a new board that's difficult. We wouldn't necessarily want to lose the entire infrastructure of that organization if instead we could halt admissions or provide some clarity. What this will do by pulling all of these into statute is give the organization the tool when they find it appropriate to revoke a license or do all these other pieces. I personally believe that they would have done that in this case and others if they had the clear authority to do it, but they lacked that authority.
But my point would be that we're instituting ambiguity when we say they may. It leaves it up to their discretion instead of what we decide that they should do. And that is, you are imperiling a child, you shall lose your license because of that, rather than give them discretion. And maybe when we talk to the folks, maybe we do need to give them a little bit, but as we have seen, that discretion gets spread out pretty wide. And some people think, well, we should get rid of them, and other people say, well, give them 44 more chances. And so if we could define it where, you know, it's very important that if they are impacting children, they are going to pay a penalty for it. Not a slap on the back or not a tickle. You're going to pay for this. You're going to lose your license. And I don't want to lose foster parents and lose agencies that do these things. But on the other side of the coin, if they are harming children, they shouldn't have the benefit of the doubt. Okay. That's why I would suggest a shall instead
point
of
well
a may.
Point well taken. And we can continue talking about
which
that as we got the drafting.
So
just kind of moving on to get through these so we can get to all the questions. Clarifying, this is already in statute and rule, but clarifying that there would be unannounced site visits at irregular time periods. Right now, licensees are already required to inform employees about their mandatory reporting responsibilities. We need to make sure that notice includes the clarification that responsibility is individual. Reporting that to the agency and holding that inside the agency does not meet that individual's obligation. And it also is against the law in Oregon for an organization to have a policy that forces that information to be to the inside. That individual must make that report every time to the child abuse hotline.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Let me interject again. I just up to your second bullet point where it says when DHS becomes aware of an investigation,
mm-hmm.
How are they informed? Should we put something in there that says that if there's another agency?
We
like
do.
DHS,
it's on another page.
On another
it's
page.
On, it's on
there
page four.
So that they
yeah.
have to report it.
Yep.
Okay.
It's coming. We'll get to page four. It'll be there. So along with this reporting, that we also want to make sure that DHS, CASAs, attorneys, and others cannot be denied immediate access to a child or the ability to look at any area of a premises. We heard that had been a problem as well, and that refusal to provide access in itself could be the grounds, and we can discuss later the may or the shall. Moving on from the licensing issues, and I promise we'll get to the other agency issues in a minute, the other issue that came up was the abuse and neglect in licensed care. One of there were a couple of problems that came up with this in talking with OWAPI, and the first is that for kids in care, the definition for abuse that's used to substantiate an allegation is the same that's used in a family home. In a family home, that standard is a minimally adequate standard. When we are providing care for vulnerable kids in state-based care, it should be a much higher standard than minimally adequate. In all of the other licensed programs that OWAPI investigates for, they have a singular definition of abuse. It would make sense to create a definition, and that's kind of an attachment that's there that is a child in care. And in that definition, we've also made sure to define that child in care as a person 20 years of age or younger, because right now OWAPI doesn't have the authority to investigate abuse of a child in their care that is between the ages of 18 and 21. So that needs to take place. A really good example of the difference between the existing definition of abuse, and what's proposed is something called willful infliction of pain. Now, you cannot, licensing rules and contracts say that a foster provider, a residential care provider, can't spank a kid, can't hurt a kid, can't willfully inflict pain. In all of the other organizations, you can substantiate an allegation of abuse if there is a willful infliction of pain. But in the OWAPI rule around kids, it says you must report willful infliction of pain, but that may or may not be abuse, because they have to get to that standard, which points back to the definition of assault and physical injury that we're going to talk about in judiciary later this week.
Yes.
And that standard is very high, because that's the impairment of a major bodily organ, or kind of putting a kid near death. It's just too high. So we end up, because all of these reports are locked up and we can't see them, what we see are this whole series of unsubstantiated allegations of abuse in kids' care. My guess is, if we were to look at those reports, we might be surprised that they were not substantiated. That's not a problem with OWAPI, it's a problem with the definition. So by creating this new definition, it would address those issues. It would also pull them out of the 419B definition, which would allow some transparency of those records, protecting the confidentiality of the foster parents and the kids, in the same way that we have transparency of records in other licensed facilities, ironically including facilities that care for children with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So this proposal is just to say kids in care should have the same level of abuse protection as seniors, adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and kids with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Madam Chair, along those lines, in your abuse definitions, you have a concern for intimidation, which says means compelling or deterring conduct by threat. So my question would be, if someone is a bad actor and you say, you don't have any computer rights tonight, would that be deterring conduct by threat?
I think Marie can probably speak to that, because that's the same standard that they substantiate to in other places. My understanding is it's a threat that would impose serious harm on that individual. If you talk to the abuse investigator, I'll give you a beating that you haven't seen before.
That I can understand, but to me the definition means that you're compelling or deterring conduct by a threat, and a threat to me would be you don't get TV tonight.
And I think we can probably have Marie talk to that.
Maybe we can define that a little bit clearer.
All right. So, and she'll be up in a minute. And then the other is, in the other programs, we also have some notifications that take place. So if a kid is the subject of an abuse investigation, it usually happens, but we want to make sure that their caseworker and their CASA know that they have been the subject of an abuse investigation. When there's a substantiation in a group facility and they've gone through the process, if there have been appeals, the caseworkers of the other children in that facility should be aware of that. That creates that elevated eyes on to those issues moving forward.
You're highlighted. Is that removal or?
Highlighted, when it's highlighted, those are the things that cause a change for a licensed provider, what would cause an issue to the people that are providing the services. Most of these are changes that impact DHS. Only the pieces highlighted impact the operations of a kids care provider.
Okay.
So what you have here that is highlighted is, well, before that if DHS is there and they think a crime is occurring in a licensed facility, they have to report that to law enforcement without delay. And then making it very clear that interference in an abusive investigation can cause you to lose your license, whether that's threatening, not allowing people to be available, falsifying records, changing incident reports, that is a real problem. So again, people that are good actors aren't doing this anyway, but that would be a new thing that could lead to a revocation of a license or a restriction on a license. There have also been some problems reported with a specific provider not allowing children to be interviewed outside the presence of supervisors or staff not being allowed to be interviewed outside the presence of their supervisors. That needs to be clear that OWAPI must have the statutory authority to talk to people one-on-one. And then this last section is that leadership accountability that we talked about. It goes to the communication that Clyde spoke about, to make sure that there's clear lines of communication within the agency and between agencies. So if the Oregon Department of Justice opens an investigation into a provider that's contracting to provide vulnerable services, they need to brief the director of the Department of Human Services, and that director must make available the appropriate staff to receive that information and receive those ongoing briefings. The same would be true, and so for DOJ, they have a whole variety of investigations. In this case, it was charitable activities. It could be the criminal division. It could be the civil rights division. It could be a whole variety of things. If there's an issue with the Department of Revenue or the Bureau of Labor and Industries, that could go to garnishments and that financial stability piece. So in those cases, we also want those agencies to be reporting that information to the department so they can be looking at the safety and long-term stability of that organization. And then the last piece is making it very clear that when an employer director of the Oregon Department of Human Services is aware of concerns about the safety of children or adults in the residential care of the state, they have to immediately take action to ensure they are appropriately investigated. And the failure to do that, the willful failure to do that, would be official misconduct. And that is that's kind of that scope of what we could do now that does not add new regulations to others. And if there are questions now, or we could bring the department up, who can probably better answer.
I have one question.
Yeah.
You've listed three departments: Revenue, Bureau of Labor and Industries, and Department of Justice. We have a lot of other agencies that could possibly do business with these folks and could have problems and concerns, such as a construction contractor board lien or something like that. Why didn't you just make it clear that any agency that has a problem should contact DHS?
That seems reasonable.
Because I think we have a lot of agencies, and certainly many more than what we have listed here will be impacted by them.
That seems reasonable.
I have no problem with that either, but I don't want to roll, for example, contractors into becoming mandatory reporters sort of stuff. Okay.
Right.
That's a little bit outside of scope.
I think the thought behind those particular entities was that it goes to the financial health of an organization. So the Department of Revenue and BOLI have the ability to issue a garnishment so that the payment that's supposed to be going to the foster care provider or the residential provider could be diverted to that other place, which would mean that money wouldn't be available to care for the kids. In some of those other places, there might be issues, but you're not directly making that payment. That lien, wouldn't that come into effect when you sell the property? Which would be
Actually, no. A lien can be foreclosed upon, which would indicate the financial health of the
agency,
of the organization. And so, it's just a thought that there's other agencies that might have contact with these folks that could be a problem. And if they don't have the ability or the wherewithal or the knowledge that they need to report it, not saying they have to, that just that if we open it to everybody that has contact with them, then you would have a broader base of seeing what's going on. That's just a concern.
Thank you. Senator Dimber.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I fully support the effort for more communication, more transparency among the agencies. How about the different levels of government, county, local government? They may very frequently be the sources of necessary information. So I don't know how we work that in, but I think that there should be a place for that.
And what's interesting is that kind of going back through to, you know, how when you start to put the measure request together, you look at the existing statute. I was surprised that a lot of this is covered in 418.260, which says that any abuses, derelictions, or deficiency made known to DHS or its agents at any time that they are reported to the department have to be carefully investigated. So this would suggest, one, that you can't close a report of abuse at screening if it's in a care facility, that they would all need to be looked at, and that may be something that we want to look at if that's really what we want the statute to say. And the other thing that's interesting is it says that these abuses, derelictions, deficiencies, or rumors of them need to be reported to the legislature. So that is our current statute. I don't know that is a statute that we're currently referencing or using on a regular basis. It's pretty old. It's from the 1980s. But I think that points to, it doesn't matter who it is that's raising the issue, it needs to be investigated. I think the issue with DOR, BOLI, and Department of Justice isn't that the department wouldn't accept those reports from anybody else, but we are proactively putting that mandate on those agencies that they need to take that proactive step in every case to make that report. I don't know that every concern that the contractors board had, for instance, should necessarily be reported to DHS. You also get this, you have too much information coming in, it can start to make it hard to sort through what's the highest priority. But I think we should keep talking about that.
Madam Chair, one of the issues that if we're getting wider range of complaints and stuff like that, one thing that's always bothered me is that with an investigation, if it becomes unfounded, it's still on the record and still might be a strike against you, even though there was nothing there. And so I'd like to see if we could kind of look at that whole aspect of it as well.
Just to follow up on that, yes. Madam Chair, as a public health nurse, I would report whenever I thought there was any mm-hmm. problem, mm-hmm. knowing that maybe there wasn't a problem, but DHS, the more information they have, and like it, well, one tick, now there's two, now there's three little ticks, they can do some follow-up. Yeah.
So is it okay to bring agency people up?
This is really simple, isn't it?
So simple. Okay. Is it okay if we bring the agency folks up?
No.
No? Would you please come visit us?
Poor people are waiting on their diet.
I know, I just overslept. Thanks for asking. Welcome, and again, I just want to thank all three of you. I know it's been a lot of work to pull all of this information together, and I also just want to acknowledge that this entire situation has been incredibly difficult, and I can't begin to imagine the toll that takes on morale and an organization, and I just really want to thank each of you publicly for the work that you've done to help find a way forward to help kids be safer. It's been impressive and important, so thank you very much. So maybe you could start with introducing yourselves.
For the record, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name's Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director at the Department of Human Services.
Chair Gelser and committee, for the record, I'm Donna Ketty, Director of the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight for Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marie Cervantes. I'm the Director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations.
Thank you. And I just wondered if you could provide a little bit of that overview of some of the challenges, where this may hit the mark, where it may be off, because we want to get it right.
Chair Gelson, members of the committee, I last was before this committee, and it was a very difficult hearing, and I heard some very difficult things, and I've spent these 2 months, you indicated, Senator Gelser, trying to go back and look at where the gaps are and how this came to be the way it is. And I think in retrospective, as Director Psyche said, there was more available information than we had at that moment, and had we had a different system, we might have had a different response. And so I really, really appreciate Director Psyche and the governor's attention to this and the efforts they're putting in place to help this department, which is large and complex but responsible for very vulnerable people, do this better. And I want to also reiterate what Director Psyche said, that and I think, Senator Gelser, you mentioned this, that really there's, I don't know of one child welfare system that's doing it perfectly in every area, but we do know there's some child welfare systems that are doing well in this area. And so the ability to bring a national perspective to what we're doing and help us change that system with all the stakeholders involved is only going to be a good thing for Oregon children and families. So I appreciate the efforts of this committee as well as the chair to bring this forward in the way it's come forward. I think this is a very good piece of legislation. There's some areas that I think we're going to have to look at and make sure we get it right in order for the legislation to be successful. And when I was here last, I provided a 2-page sheet of the state and federal regulations and statutes that impact our ability in child welfare to release records of investigations and reports. And so what I really am hopeful that we're doing with the Department of Justice is take a really close look at those statutes to ensure that that particular provision is possible, and that we're still especially meeting our federal standard, because so much of our funding is federal funding. So that was one piece that I want us to make sure we take a really critical look at. The expansion of licensing NOAPI to address our 18 to 20-year-old population is very important. I actually did not realize that NOAPI didn't have the authority to do investigations on our 18 to 20-year-old population. And that was federally expanded, and Oregon's had that expanded for some time. So that is a very important piece. These children remain, I won't call them children, these youth remain committed to the department past the age of 18, and they need the same protections 0 to 18 have. So that piece of this legislation is critical, and the ability for the licensing department to actually license child caring facility or agencies that are caring for what we don't generally consider to be children, 18 to 20-year-olds, is important to us as well. One of the pieces that Director Ketty has raised to me is that we have to be careful when we do that to look at our mix of population. And I think she's absolutely right, and that's something we can take care of in rule. I don't think it needs statute, but the expansion is really important to us. Let me see what others. Dual certification, I think, is important as well. I believe we have more information in our system when we're looking at foster parents we certify than child caring agencies have available to them when they're certifying. If we have dual certification, that issue goes away. So I would like for us to do that. That will be an additional resource to then, I don't know how many homes there are certified currently by child caring agencies, but I would imagine there are quite a few. They were 10 at one point under Give Us This Day. So I think that we're going to have to look at how we can accomplish that, but I think that's a critical piece. We have what we call the Safe Home Study, which is really one where you look for issues and then you have to create mitigations to those issues if they exist for people to be certified. Our child caring agencies don't necessarily use that same study tool, and we'd like to have that available for any home a child committed to the department is placed in, regardless of who's managing that home. The section about leadership accountability, to me, is very important. I think, Senator Olson, you referenced that the higher you go in an organization, the more narrowing the information tends to get. And I think that the more open our system is to all having the information, the full body of information at the same time, we'll make better decisions. So I appreciate the clarity of the leadership accountability section, and I think it's very good direction for the department. If that makes it through in this legislation, it makes it very clear who gets to know what information when, and compels us to bring people together so we have a full picture. When Director Psyche spoke to his surprise, we didn't have a formal structure of staffing concerns about particular providers. That's true. I don't want the committee to think we didn't staff concerns about particular providers, but we didn't have a regular way of bringing people together with a routine, with a structure that ensured all the information was on the table at any given time. When you take a sort of 2020 look back, it's distressing, and it is it's clear we had more information. Had we been able to bring it all together in a structured way, we might have made different decisions. And I feel responsible for helping see this through to ensure that that doesn't occur again. So thank you. Those are my comments, and if there's questions after these ladies comment, that'd be great.
Can I just ask a clarifying question? Lois, when you said a structure for bringing people together, Which people were you thinking of?
The structure we currently have is we have the child welfare program in central office with a field structure out in the field. We have licensing, which license all of our child caring agencies. And then we have OWAPI, which does our child abuse investigations in facilities. So a call can come in, and I think that Director Cervantes will talk about a call doesn't generally come directly into OWAPI about abuse or neglect allegations of a child caring agency. It comes into one of our 15 hotlines and then gets, because it deals with the facility, immediately referred to OWAPI. And so there's a chance for a loss of information there. Licensing, as was said before, really only has the ability to license or not. And the bar is pretty high for revocation of a license. That doesn't afford them a lot of ability to dupe. So they may have concerns and issues, but there's not a remedy necessarily to those. In program, the central office staff, we have what we call contracted compliance staff. And every time a child, these facilities are licensed, and then when a child is going to be placed in one, we have an individual child-specific contract. And they look to see if, and it's a random poll, it's not everyone, because we have four of those to complement their three licensing folks. But they look to see if the elements of the contract are adequately documented in this random pull of child files from the facility. But that doesn't get to anything about the larger picture of the facility. So all of those entities come together to talk about facilities, but we really don't always have all the information in one place. And I'm afraid I rambled a little bit talking about the way the system's designed, so I want to make sure I answered your question.
Yeah, I think you have. And so are you envisioning periodic meetings of that brings people together with a sort of facility focus?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dembro, yes. The radar list was mentioned earlier. So the list comes to a number of people and you see it, but attached to that radar list, I feel that we should have some sort of action that goes along with it. So I could not have told you, Give Us This Day was on that list 26 out of the last 36 months, because it comes each month. It's cumulative. Sometimes programs not on there, sometimes there are. I think it's a great means for licensing to alert a group of people to issues that are going on, but it takes on sort of an ongoing flavor versus an action-oriented flavor. And I think we need an action-oriented flavor around when, not flavor, action-oriented process when those sort of issues are raised versus just an informational process.
And I just wanted to add something to this as well. When this happened and the issues came to light, and some of us read through kind of the public records requests, and it's overwhelming to see all of that information that's pulled by a specific search term over a period of years. I think what I learned from that process after the initial shock, if you go back, here we have sitting here three independent departments within the agencies. And some of you received some of those emails. None of you received all of that email or all of that information. And in addition to these three agencies, there's also finance and contract. And in terms of the placements and who's out there, you've got the caseworkers, you've got the regions, you've got the local child welfare offices. That's a lot of information to be scattered in one place. And I think that piece of that 2020 hindsight, we pull it all together and we look at, gosh, there's this huge body of information, but it's like everybody had that little piece. It's like the elephant where you have the one person with the flashlight and you see the one piece. If there's a structure to pull it all together, then finally you can see that whole elephant that's sitting there in the room to be able to address it. But I don't think you've had the tools and the organizational structure, organizational chart to be able to bring all that information into one place. And even if you had, I mean, you could substantiate an allegation of abuse that is very, very troubling, but that doesn't give you the ability to take that child out of the home or revoke the license. You don't have the ability to revoke the license or make one foster home shut down because you don't, in child welfare, you aren't dual licensed, so you can't say we're not licensing that provider anymore. It goes to the license that's over there. So the problems were significant, but I don't know that all the tools were there to address it.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I think you've actually very well described what the experience has been going back and seeing the variety of communications and intersections that were occurring. And in fact, when OWAPI has a substantiated allegation of abuse in a residential or child caring agency, by the time that conclusion is reached, generally the child has either been moved or the safety action has taken place. If that particular allegation was deemed to be a child-specific and somewhat based on that interaction that child's having with staff, it may not be viewed as a risk to other children. And so the piece here, I think that I believe you were trying to get at around the well-being part of the assessment that's done when there's any abuse investigation is important. One of the other things I wanted to point out, and then I'll stop talking and let these ladies talk, was that OWAPI and child welfare investigations operate from different sets of OARs that don't necessarily match. And there is a difference in an investigation of an incident that occurs in a child caring agency from one we do in someone's home, because there's some responsibility on that child caring agency to monitor their staff and do the things that the agency's supposed to do. And so the investigations are not really the same. And I think one of the efforts that I want us to undertake, and we've already started a process, had started it this summer, was to really walk through how these investigations occur and how it matches up with the investigations we do as in child welfare does in the family homes and in foster homes, family foster homes, to see where the differences are so that we don't have differences, and where the gaps are to get those filled. So I'm hopeful that that process that's underway will feed the external look critical information around how we're designed. Thank you.
Thank you. Austin
Wilson. You had mentioned that if you had a different system, things might have been different. My concern is that you have this group of managers, directors of different portions of your agency. Doesn't anybody ever chat? Anybody ever sit down and chat and go, you know, gosh, if I could have done this? It just concerns me that we have this bureaucracy that trundles down the road, but doesn't coordinate for perfection. And it's going on for such a long time, it just amazes me. Now, if this is something that was a short term, I could say, you know, we can understand it. But this is going on for a long, 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 long time, and it just, I don't understand why directors don't sit down once a week and say, hey, Jim, this is going on over here. What do you think about that? Is there a way to fix this? Do you do that?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, we have a lot of conversation around both design, delivery, results, and that's why I was saying it's disturbing to me how we have all that conversation and didn't have more definitive action at different times. And I think that Senator Gelser has said a couple of times, and it's really true, that there is a lack of some tools to do that. And what this situation has afforded us, if there's something positive out of it, is that look back where we said, okay, we were having a lot of conversations, and we saw some things that didn't quite fit, and we were taking some action, but it wasn't enough. And now we have the opportunity, both with internal audits and an external review of our program, to create substantial change and significant change that will correct some of the things that might have distressed us in the past, some of the things that did distress us, but we couldn't quite get fixed. So I think we had a lot of conversations. We do talk to each other. In, I think it was March, Director Cervantes and I sat down and said, we've got some differences in our programs. We've got to address it. And that's what this current effort, the RPI that is underway, was designed to address. I wish we had done it 4 years ago. But at that time, that wasn't the conversation. But we did get to a place where we realized that and we're having the conversation. I like to believe we try to manage towards the best we can put together. I'm not certain we'll reach perfection, but I think everybody in this process has been very committed to having a conversation and looking at issues. We just didn't get broad enough and deep enough in our past conversation. And I take responsibility for my part in that.
Thank you, Les. Let's move on to Donna or Marie. I don't know which who wants to go next.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee. First, I would just like to say that I'm very appreciative of the proposed legislation. I think it does touch on so many things that we have lacked for quite some time. And I think that many of your questions would be well served by this legislation. Much of what licensing does is a process, and I think that has kind of been born inherently from this lack of actual interim steps to compliance that we have had for so long. As Senator Gelser said, we have the ability to open a program and then along the way of compliance and monitoring and correction, we have almost nothing that we can do that is substantive beyond closure. And I think the proposed legislation does give us some of those interim steps. As so many others have said, the majority of providers are wonderful. They're stellar and caring providers, and they exceed the rules. But we are here because of those that don't. And so when the time comes for us to step forward and hold them to accountability, you know, having the tools to do that will make a significant difference in our ability going forward. Everything that we do is such a process. The application in and of itself is a process. So as Senator Gelser pointed out, there are hundreds of rules. Before you get a license, you have to be in 100% compliance with those rules. And that's our point at the very beginning, that we actually have some teeth to deny a license. Once they're in compliance, then every 2 years, the rule requires that we're on site to do a compliance visit and a renewal of the license. And we have three staff that have carried that particular task, along with all the other licensing tasks for many years. Actually, we had two licensors until about 2 years ago. You know, I think that much of what Director Day said is so spot on. We have all worked within our particular offices, and having that collective place to formalize action has been a gap. And so that's, you know, a very good retrospective thing that we've learned from this. We do have an informal communication system. As Senator Gelser pointed out, the radar list is something that we've produced out of licensing as a heads up to the organization. And you can be on that list. It isn't necessarily because of a lack of compliance. It could be something else. But the majority of providers that are on that list are there for a challenge that they have in complying. If you've had an opportunity to look at it, the majority of providers do reach compliance within the 45-day requirement. There are a few that over time have not. And when that's the case, it's a significant struggle. To reference that document, there is one provider that you've noted has been on that list for 36 months. And not to take the time today to do that unless you want me to, but they're a wonderful case in point. They have been subject to every tool that we possibly have, including intent to revoke, with a subsequent settlement agreement, with site visits, random site visits monthly thereafter, and continuing lack of compliance. And our rules do not find them to be out of substantial compliance such that we can take that action. With this legislation, we would be able to take interim steps like restriction of admission or the hiring of consultants or something that would give some strength to the regulatory process beyond closure. The other piece that will be clearly influenced by this legislation is that, you know, we we take action relative to facts and conclusions, not emotion or our wishes. And in the course of investigations of any kind that can be lengthy, we can't act, because until the investigation is concluded, we don't have the authority, and it won't uphold during the due process. So if there's an allegation of abuse and it's under investigation, we can't act until the conclusion comes forward. We act with respect to informal action. We protect, we ensure safety, we do extra visits and extra monitoring. But in terms of tools to take legal or due process course of action, we have not had that ability. With this legislation and some opportunity to take interim steps, if there's an allegation of abuse not yet concluded, but we believe that it's significant and reasonable to assume that it may be founded and it may potentially be harmful to children, we can take those steps, short of closing the program and while waiting for the conclusion. So I'm open to any questions that you might have. That's kind of my ramble of where we are right now.
Senator Olson.
I always have questions.
Has questions, and Senator Dimbrough has raised his finger. So we'll.
It concerns me that you'd mentioned the fact that proposals cover what has lacked for quite some time. Don't you ever just sit there and go, you know, if I had this tool in my toolbox, I could fix this problem? And if you've thought about that, why didn't you move that up the line and bring it forward so we could fix it?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I do think that way, but more often than not, we're focused on putting our energies into trying to work with the provider and help them to come into compliance. And 9.9 times out of 10, that is an effective course of action. It takes longer, but that's where we've put our energy. You know, I think we have a culture of compliance, a culture of helping technical assistance, bringing technical assistance to providers. And that is generally the predominant approach that we've taken over the years. The providers are, we don't have an abundance of providers, and the majority of them are very, very effective. We have had conversations, and we have brought legislation forward in the past to try and influence getting application fees and a structure for civil penalties so that we could try to resource the staff and the quality of care and try and provide some additional oversight, and that legislation did not go forward. I think that with Senator Gelser's memo that will come forward again, and I'm looking forward to that.
And can I just quickly?
Sure.
Because what I heard in your question was why, and I want to answer and then let you fix my answer. But I heard in your question, if you knew there was this problem or you needed this tool, why didn't you come to the legislature and say, give us this tool?
Well, not the legislature, just go up the ladder to the boss, and then let the boss come to the legislature and say, hey, we need an additional tool. I'm in the building industry, and if I need something to move something, I'll get it. And I won't hesitate. I won't say, well, no, I could probably do it another way. I'll get the tool, and that's what you should do, is come and get the tool. Go to your boss and say, this is what I need to get this done. Now, I won't always have to use it, but if I have it available, if I have my jack in my car, I can jack my car up and change the tire. If I don't have the jack, I'm in trouble. So my question is, why didn't you bring that forward earlier? I mean, you see the problems.
And then if I could build on that and reframing the question a little bit, I seem to recall from when working at DHS that a policy person or a program person could identify a problem and elevate it to their manager, but the agency is very big, and the process of elevating something up to the point of a policy option package that goes through that whole process, goes to the governor's office, and then staff are kind of free to talk to the legislature or the director about is a complicated process. I mean, can you just come and say, hey, I really need this tool, and when you have an idea, know that it's going to show up as a proposal?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, it is a complicated process. It goes through many layers and tiers, and We have had the fortune of having some legislation go forward in the past relative to licensing, but we haven't had a whole lot of success in rising to the level of it being a priority.
You couldn't turn around and walk over to Clyde and sit down next to him and said, hey, if we had this, we could make this work. That's not the way that your system works. You've got to go up.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I absolutely can. And actually, Clyde has been very open to that conversation, and we have a meeting. He's directed a meeting next week, I believe, for us to talk about not just proposed legislation, but the details of individual agencies and where they are in terms of compliance. So Director Psyche is very committed to us having those more detailed conversations. The agency restructured a few years ago and pulled together all of the areas of licensing into one office, and so we've been going through some growing pains since that restructure. Now under licensing, we have the aging and people with disabilities licensing, the children's licensing, and we're working on our governance structures to make it more formal. It has been a less formal process. We have had the ability to step forward and say, I have an issue amongst all of the, multitude of other issues. But I think we are in a better place now going forward to have a much more structured, formal communication structure and governance structure to connect all of these different offices. The Office of Abuse Investigation and Child Welfare, we do talk and we do communicate, and we have ongoing relationships, and we work somewhat in tandem, but the formalized process has not necessarily been there.
Madam Chair. If a subordinate...
Senator Dimbrough gets a turn. Okay.
If a subordinate comes to you,
yes,
and says, hey, boss, I think if we did this, we could make the whole process work better.
Yes.
What's the procedure? What do you do with it?
If we have a continuous improvement approach, we would develop a continuous improvement project around it if it's a non-emergent issue, and follow that up through what is a fairly detailed structure. If it's something for a legislative concept, we would follow that as it is timely. If it's an incident that is of a more emergent nature, we would do more or less an email heads up to agency leadership and try to make connection with that leader and the related department managers and unit managers. That is the process that we've utilized historically.
I don't quite understand the
follow
process.
Follow up. And then Senator Dimbrough really gets a turn.
Okay. Yes.
If a subordinate comes to you with an idea,
yes,
to make things better, you just made a convoluted process. You just spread it out all over the whole floor.
Yeah.
Why can't you just say, let's sit down with the other folks in my division here, my agency, and see if this is a good idea, put it down on paper, and send it up the ladder instead of this process that you just talked about? It didn't.
Senator
it confuses
Gelser,
me.
Vice
and,
Chair
and I'm
Olson.
New to this, so it, yeah, it's
no,
interesting.
I do appreciate your. I wish it were so simple, and sometimes it is and can be if it's a simple process, because the work that we do touches on so many areas and has so many implications. There isn't any one of us who knows everything and can work up through a process without considering the impacts it may have on other parts of the system. So the continuous improvement process is one that helps us to look at it from differing angles before taking action. If it's a simple process, we absolutely can make change and do that and welcome those. Yes.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, there is a formal process in the department for elevating issues that may need legislation, policy option packages, at those, and pretty much anyone can come to their director or to their supervisor and say, this needs to change, something different could happen. And because we're such a large organization, there's lots of good ideas, and what actually ends up going to the governor's office, things get winnowed down from there, and then the governor makes her decision around what she will put forward in her recommended budget and in potential legislation. And then it comes to the legislature, and there's a process that a lot of things don't get on that list in any given year. That said, we can change rules internally and don't require legislation, and I think we're continually in a process of changing our rules to make them to improve the delivery we have based on that level. But to actually get things in front of the legislature, it is a much more complicated process. And I believe all three of us have the same sort of approach that Director Psyche indicated, which is the door is open. In fact, none of us have a door. We sit in cubicles with our staff. So it's we do have that culture, I believe, at DHS, where we encourage anyone to bring forward something they think will make the system better. I also think what Director Ketty was referencing when she said a rapid process improvement, we did several years ago as a department adopt lean as a method of line staff actually elevating issues which could make their work more efficient and more effective and have a pretty rapid process of something simple actually just being put in there, and then those issues get risen to the state level where there's a governance group to say, could this help statewide? But increasing the power of the licensing office to have interim measures on a license versus just having the ability to terminate a license isn't a rapid process improvement effort, unfortunately.
And I think one piece that's important to the question that you asked too was, if you go to your supervisor, why does it have to be a big process? I've really struggled to get my head around this, and I still don't think I completely have my head around it, but have started to better understand it over the last week. I don't think I appreciated the complexity of the organizational structure of the Department of Human Services and the disbursement of both power and responsibility. So my perception was that Lois, for instance, was all powerful and could address and had the power to fix everything. Lois may be very powerful and compassionate, but the organizational structure doesn't give her all of that responsibility and tools. It's shared amongst a bunch of different people. So am I understanding correctly that if I have an issue that I want to change and I'm an employee in your department and I come to talk to you, that idea may touch on pieces that different directors have responsibility or authority over, and that's not all vested directly in you, and that's why it would end up being spread across the entire floor.
Chair Gelser, you're absolutely right, and you said it much better than I did, but yes, that's what I was trying to say.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering if there are no doors, how they could actually have an open door policy.
Senator Dimbrough.
Thank you. Donna, the question of, or let me put it this way, how is the decision made of where to place a child? I mean, DHS has latitude in making that decision currently, right? I mean, if, for example, you know, a firm is deemed to be, you know, questionable, you don't have to send a child to that location, do you?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dembrough, just to clarify, I speak from the licensing perspective, and we've drawn a very definitive line that licensing does not do placement. We allow them to be open for business, and then they seek their own contracts. And so I would defer to Lois on mm-hmm. that.
So if, for example, a place has been on the radar list for a number of months, you don't have to send additional children to them, do you? I realize desperate situations might cause you to do so, but you don't have to.
Chair Gelser, Senator Dembrough, we are not required to use any particular placement for a child. That's the easy and correct answer. No, we don't have to place. But I think part of the conversation we've had before is the dynamic in our system of, do we have enough of the right homes at the right places at the right times to serve all of the children and their unique needs when they come into care? And I think the answer is no. We don't have enough. And what it requires for really a healthy foster care system is that you have an overabundance of placements so that match can be made. This particular facility was a shelter facility, not intended to be a long-term placement, but somewhere a child could be while they were moving to their next placement, either because one wasn't available or hadn't been identified, or because they lost their prior placement for some reason and we needed to determine what the next best placement would be. There were some children that did well in this setting, and there were others that clearly were not getting their needs met. We have three other shelter programs in Oregon. And that's all. So that interim spot, I think one of the things the Alliance raised in their communication with the committee was, why do we have so many emergency placements? Because we have children with increasing needs and a limited pool of available placements with the skill sets that can meet those needs. And our goal has been to increase that. I believe in the committee tomorrow, Representative Kenny Geyer's committee, there's going to be a presentation on some sort of innovative things that are happening in Oregon around how to increase our population of foster homes and child caring agencies. And we're always looking for the opportunity to do that. And so there's some hope that we will be able to expand our system in a way that gives us more options when placing. But no, again, we don't have to use any particular placement. The way these placements, BRS and shelter placements, are made is the worker looks within the system and finds what looks to be an appropriate placement for the child at that time, and then we have contract writers in the field that will write the contract, child-specific contract, so they can actually place in that facility.
So that means when a kid is going in, even though you've seen that radar list, the people that are making that match out in the field are not people that have been seeing that radar list.
Chair Gelser, that's correct. And workers are working off the list of licensed child caring agencies that have openings. And I don't think it's an actual list. They work with these contract writers in the field to know where their openings. There's some assist because the system is it's finite. And their kids are placed, children are placed from various regions around the state, maybe in a totally different region because that's where that particular bed exists for them.
I guess if I could just follow up, I think what I'm getting at, maybe we should wait until we hear from Director Cervantes just to get the total picture, but I agree with virtually every element of this proposed legislation, but, I'm just wondering as the bottom line, to what extent will this prevent a similar situation as happened with Give Us This Day? How much of it is really, the statutory authority, how much of it is the communication, the coordination, the actual administrative practices?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dimbrough, I think this legislation is a piece of the solution, but it's not the total solution. And I think Director Psyche spoke to the culture of the department and how we conduct our business within. And I think these audits that are underway and the external review is going to help us adjust that so that it fills those gaps. And the totality of these efforts, I'm very hopeful, will give us the tools we need and the adjustments we need as the large agency that we are, including the field structure, so that we can prevent this kind of activity occurring again.
Director Cervantes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to respond first around the structure of our offices. I think Director Keddy alluded to that. I've had the honor of being one of the hosts of an advisory committee around House Bill 2233. And it took us almost three meetings to go over the entire structure of the department, how it worked together, what the different roles and responsibilities were. So it's incredibly complex. Those records are available for you to view. They're public records if you'd like to see that. Out of that came three large size legal charts with all the workflows for each of the offices that were involved. And that would include child welfare, the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, child welfare, the Oregon Youth Authority, and our office. So just to let you know, we're working through that. I think Director Day mentioned about a rapid process improvement that we've been working on, and that conversation began early in 2015. And it really was around some of the things that we're seeing around double screenings and using different rules for children's investigations, and really wanting to understand how the structure was set up when it originated in 2007, and if we were following the lines that were created at that time, or did we need to make changes to that. Looking at the legislative concept that we're talking about today, I think that concept is going to fix several of those things that we have identified in that rapid process improvement, so I look forward to those changes. I'd like to speak a little bit to some of the particular pieces of the legislation and then take some questions if you'd like. I am definitely supportive of transparency of records. We have public records in most of our, all of our other program areas, so that's certainly welcome. Expanding our authority to cover children 18 to 20 within CCPs is also a very important part of our business. In regard to the definitions, I think there was a question, Senator Olson, that you had earlier around the definitions of abuse, you know, and what might fall within that category. And we assess the risk and look at the likelihood of something to endanger the health, safety, and welfare of a child. So that's how we get at that determination and reaching a conclusion of abuse. So the current definitions we have around negligent treatment and maltreatment are fairly broad. But there are some tightening up that can be done around jurisdiction and our authority. Certainly any kind of rule that allows us access to a facility at all times and access to records and that a provider must give those to us will help us. It'll also help us with our timeline, so we appreciate that. In terms of working together structurally, I think this is a governance issue that we need to work on. As Director Ketty had shared, we've worked on building governance structures with the aging and physical disabilities area. We have meetings that are set up with line level managers and then with the leadership. We have an executive steering committee built within that program to raise and escalate other issues. We're building that right now with the Office of Developmental Disability Services and moving in that direction, and then we'll do it with each of the different offices. So that's where the structure gets very complicated. You have to build five of these governance structures within the department and try to set all those up. So that's a lot of information flowing back and forth very quickly and all at once often. I think part of the, just to go back to the abuse definitions, part of the challenge is that all the abuse calls go into the 15 child abuse hotlines. And so, you know, we often receive what we do. And I think that creates some opportunity to streamline some of the practices in that area. So when we look at definitions and how calls come in, I think that, that there's some work to do there as well. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
So I had a specific question around the records transparency for, and I think Director Day raised a really important question about making sure that we meet those federal requirements around the confidentiality of kids' records. Are your records for children with intellectual and developmental disabilities placed through SPD, are those accessible in the same way your adult DD senior physical disability investigations are protected?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is that they're not. They're protected under the child abuse rules and statutes. So we follow along with Director Day and use the applicable statutes and rules to release those records.
And that's true when it's the abuse, because you're currently, so for kids, like in an ID provider, you're substantiating under a different definition of abuse than a children's care provider that's not specifically an ID provider.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. When we do investigations for children with intellectual and developmental disabilities, the first screening occurs at the child hotline, and it's using the child welfare family abuse rule. And then the second set of rules that are used within our office are actually the intellectual and developmental disabilities adult rule, because it's broader in scope, and that's how we convene our investigations.
So does that mean those calls that go in, or if we change this definition here, if it went through the hotline and we broaden, for instance, to use that willful infliction of pain, since that is not doesn't meet the standard of abuse in child welfare, does that mean that would get closed screening at that intake? So if we change the rule, or if we change the statute, the definitions of abuse, but the hotline screens based on the child welfare in-home definition, are those going to get screened out at the hotline before they get to you, even though it would meet the statutory definition of abuse for a licensed care facility?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is a possibility. So we need to make sure that the rule change applied in both places.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thanks. And actually this is probably for Director Keddie, but going back to the radar list, I'm impressed in a positive way that the number of facilities that remain on the list for a number of months is very small. That's good. And I'm just wondering how, and that's good because obviously fewer children are at risk, but also it allows you to really focus your resources on the problem facilities and steer them through technical resources or peer support or whatever in a positive direction. And so I'm wondering what is being done, in helping facilities to get off the list other than, threatening them that they could face shutdown if they don't get off the list. I mean, what are some of the positive supports that are available, and are there enough?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dembrough, that's a very good question. First of all, the radar list represents the facilities that have kind of an elevated concern of some sort. But out of every survey that we do or inspection that we do, there are corrective actions. I think we average about 5 of the domains per site visit review. And within that domain, there are multiple rules that may have been out of compliance. So basically, the three staff that cover the programs across the state will try and provide them with a tool that might be more appropriate than the tool they've used. Many of the areas of lacking in compliance might be that the policies aren't updated appropriately, or they're using an approach that maybe could be more aligned better. So we try to provide tools. We try to point toward resources that are more helpful and effective to get the job done. There are examples from other providers that may be helpful. We really try to stay close with the provider and their corrective action plan that they receive after every site visit, and try to help them in the best, most expeditious way to work their way through the corrective actions. And as you've noted, for the most part, they comply within the 45-day time frame. Does that answer your question?
I wanted to go back to Director Cervantes for a minute, going back to the abuse definitions. And I have two. One, do you think it would be appropriate to have that same set of definitions for abuse in the licensed kids facilities as you do in the other licensed facilities? And the second question is, under the current definitions that you operate under, do you think a typical Oregonian, if they were to see the things that you are unable to substantiate for abuse, do you think there are cases where the typical Oregonian would think that those are circumstances that maybe are not appropriate for state-paid care?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe there's plenty of opportunities in the abuse and neglect rules to strengthen those. As far as members of the public seeing things that might be screened out that would be problematic, I think that our screening rule has enough its lack of structure that could be tightened up to make it very, very clear on what cases we can screen in or screen out. I also think clarity between the roles of the different offices, so what constitutes an abuse definition, an investigation versus what's a licensing issue, are very, very important as well, because both of those can speak to the safety of a child. As does the placement of a child.
Let me ask it in a different way. So we have the public record around abuse investigations in CCPs is the number of investigations, the number that are substantiated, and the number are unsubstantiated. You have access to understanding what's unsubstantiated, and it has to be unsubstantiated if it doesn't meet that definition. Do you think it's fair for the public to assume that in every case that there is an unsubstantiated report, that means that the child has been in a good situation, has not been harmed or injured, and it's not a problem?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't know that I could say that. I think that we look at a burden of proof, preponderance of evidence to determine that. I would also say that part of the reason a lot of calls come in to our office is that we have a very healthy reporting by our CCP providers. So we go out and do a lot of outreach and training so that they call in a lot of different things. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Not really. No. I guess just because something is unsubstantiated, does that mean a child has not been injured or harmed, or that level of care is what we would expect to be provided?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, it does not. It just means it doesn't meet the preponderance of evidence for our investigations.
And is it the preponderance of evidence, or is it that specific definition? For instance, willful infliction of physical pain. Yeah. So if it did not lead to a significant physical injury, could you substantiate that under the CCP rules?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it would be both. So the screening coming in would play an important role. So if the definition didn't allow us to screen it and investigate it, then it would turn out to be unsubstantiated, to answer that part of your question. It's also partly how we conclude the investigation and weigh the evidence. So the answer would be both. Both areas would be important in determining that.
Okay, thank you. There are other... So I had one more question. So in the rule around this idea of willful infliction of pain on a child, in the OWAPI rule, it says that has to be reported for investigation, but just because there's been a physical injury or just because the provider has willfully inflicted pain upon a child, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's abuse. Can you describe a non-abusive situation where somebody willfully would inflict pain upon a child?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, typically where we see that abuse definition used is when there is an injury caused by other than accidental means. So that might be a injury that occurred on a playground or during sports or something like that. That's where we typically see that.
Although that willful, I mean, when I read the words willful infliction of physical pain, I think about taking a spatula or a belt or a hand and whacking a kid or kicking a kid or pushing a kid into a wall or throwing a kid down on the ground. Is that appropriate to take place within a facility, and would that always be substantiated as abuse under the rule that you're operating under right now?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if it resulted in an endangerment to the health, safety, and welfare of the child or created a substantial risk to the child, then yes, it would be substantiated.
But if they just were hurt, if they just had a broken limb or they just had a black eye, that wouldn't necessarily be substantiated.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it would depend on the circumstances. We would certainly want to screen that in and investigate that. Mm-hmm. It just depends on the situation and the circumstances involved in the investigation.
I'll follow up on this.
You know where I'm trying to get.
Yes, I'm going to be introducing legislation to change the definition of physical injury. Mm-hmm. I wasn't successful last time, being told that it was too broad, and so we're going to narrow the definition to the most vulnerable population. I've been working with the Crook County DA, the Washington County DA, and the Multnomah County DA on trying to get language. So because there have been cases that where there's obvious abuse and it doesn't hold up in court. And so it would be very helpful. We're going to be having a hearing in Judiciary Wednesday afternoon just to talk about the concepts. And it would be nice to be able to have you at least listen to it to see if you have input on this type of situation, because we are seeing that there is abuse happening, but it's easier to convict someone who abuses an animal than it is to convict someone who abuses a human. So we're focusing on vulnerable. That would be children. The definition of a child will come into a play here. The disabled, the elderly, those who really can't speak for themselves. So we have an issue, and we need to have the system work. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to get something like this through. But the more input maybe that you could give to us, too, would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson. I think part of the distinction with the child care provider programs is that what you just described falls under the maltreatment. And maltreatment is an action towards a child which carries a risk of harm to the child's physical, emotional, behavioral, mental health, or welfare. And that's where you'll see examples of hitting, kicking, pushing, willful infliction of pain and injury. So it's a little different than how it is in the adult system.
Or the kids' IDD.
Kids system.
Is correct. There any reason why would you support just having that same standard across the board, the same definition?
Yeah.
Is there a reason that it should be different in CCPs than it is for IDDD or adults in licensed facilities?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would support that.
Okay, thank you. And then one other question that I had is, if a person is coming to DHS to be licensed as a foster care parent, are they subject to the same standards as if that person went to a foster care agency?
Chair Gelso, members of the committee, I just briefly touched on that, which is why the dual certification is important, that they are not the same. And part of it is that when someone goes to a child caring agency and wants to be certified as a foster parent, they are interacting with that child caring agency about their past history. We do a child welfare and a criminal record check, but there could be additional history that the department would have. If that's not raised by the individual when they go to that other entity, they may never know that a history exists, and we won't know that they're fostering for that family. So the dual certification would get the same level of scrutiny for all fostering homes, regardless of whether they were homes licensed by the department or licensed by a child caring agency.
And then my understanding, too, is that the other reason the dual certification might be important, if you have a bad actor out there that's a CCP that's licensing, even though their policies that you look at in licensing might say these are the requirements to certify, you have no way of knowing that the people that they're telling you are okay are actually meeting the standard that the state would require.
Chair Gelso, the child caring agency is responsible for those foster homes. You're absolutely correct.
Are there any other questions for this panel? No, thank you all so very much, and for answering so many questions over the last couple of months, and especially around the complexity of the management of the agency. I think that's something I just want to publicly say to Lois directly, is that there is so much that is there, and it's hard to wrap my mind around that. And I just appreciate the work that you're all doing to try to make this better for kids. And I know that you are all doing this work in the first place. These are the careers that you've chosen because you want to create safe and welcoming places for kids that need it most. So thank you to all of you, especially Lois, and thanks for being here.
Chair Gelso, thank you, and I want to thank you for your efforts, mm-hmm. as well as the committee for their attention to this over this last several months. It's been very helpful to us, and I just want to put on the record that I am not all-powerful. appreciate the recognition of the complexity of our system and the assistance to make it better.
Thank you. And was there anything you all wanted to add that you didn't get a chance to do on these topics?
I did have one thing, just okay. As an update to the committee, Chair Gelso, members of the committee, I wanted to let them know that in this process, we engaged with the field, and every child was staffed to identify their specific needs, and we have made placement for all of them in either a facility or foster home where those needs are being met. It was a very conscious effort. A lot of energy in the field went into making sure that the children who had to move to a place that was better for them. And if they were staying, that it was the appropriate place and the appropriate licensure was in place.
Thank you,
Madam
very much.
Chair. I'm really shocked after all these years to find out that Lois isn't all powerful. I'm always a
certain Senator Cruz, perhaps you can rectify that for me.
In the other work group, we can talk about that. Okay.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Now lost my agenda. Can I borrow your agenda? Why, thank you. All right, so so we've talked about the omnibus bill. We've talked about the licensing bill. The third one that is potentially a committee bill, you may recall that we have a charitable pharmacy. This is totally a different topic. Charitable pharmacy program that says sealed, unused prescriptions can be re-prescribed to people that that are either uninsured or underinsured. And then we expanded that to allow that to work within a hospice or a nursing home so that you don't have as much waste of drugs. So the request that has come is that the definition right now of sealed and unopened is kind of that entire prescription. But if you have a prescription that comes in a blister pack, so you have like 12 individually sealed doses, if one of those is there and 11 is done, you have to toss it out. This would allow that blister pack at the nursing home or the hospice care that those 11 other pieces would not have to get thrown away.
That sounds relatively logical, Madam Chair.
So the state is the obstacle to that? I assume it was federal.
No, it's the way that we defined what the sealed was. There's another state that has recently made this clarification as well.
So have we defined that the unused drugs, the person that's going to get them has a prescription to use those unused drugs?
Yes. It all goes back through a pharmacist through a prescription. Okay. So I can't just come and give you my drugs.
Oh, shoot.
Okay. So we're going to end that. So we're going to end the informational hearing on the committee bill proposals. And we're at 10:05, and we get to have Director Day again and Stacey Ayers and Chris Edmonds just in case to talk about child abuse screenings, abuse investigations, and child fatalities. And just for some transparency of the goal of all of this, we talked earlier about when there's an issue that arises in the department and it appears that there's something that would fix things, how do people elevate that? One of the things that, if you read back through the child fatality reviews, that has frequently been noted is an issue with screening. And the department has had a proposal for a central screening tool and training to improve the quality of screening. The legislature has not been particularly responsive to that. I don't know that we've talked about it a lot, and this is the opportunity to talk about what that need is and what the consequence is when we don't listen to the tools that you tell us that you need.
With the all-powerful Lois Day.
And it's the all-powerful Lois Day is back.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to talk about our screening process, our investigations, and then we're going to speak to our critical incident review team process and how corrective actions that come out of those reviews are implemented to improve our system. I just have brief slides, and I've brought my expert, Stacey Ayers, who's a safety manager in program, to really talk through the details of our screening process. But just some basic information, we received over almost 68,000 reports in 2014. That's a lot of calls. And of those, almost 30,000 were assigned for assessment. We've had a number of screening reviews, and Stacey will speak to those when he talks. And there is identified in our CERT process a systemic issue related to the comprehensiveness of our screening. We have 15, I say quality assurance is difficult in the current structure because we have 15 hotlines around the state where we receive calls, plus a statewide hotline that then refers out to one of those 15 depending upon the geography. And what this structure does is it really gives rise to issues with how do we train our screeners, how do we ensure consistency of the application of our rules when they're doing that screening, and then how do we ensure coverage. So if we try to pull all our screeners together from our hotlines to train and do some interreliability work around consistency, there's no one answering the phone that's a trained screener. So that's been a challenge for us. in two places we've had one of the certs in, I believe it was 2011, recommended that the state investigate a centralized hotline, one hotline for the state that serves the entire state. At that time, we were unable to go forward because of resources. But as we began implementing differential response, it again became apparent to us that we really need to do something with our screenings, in part because now we have a category of families that interact with the department that don't result in a finding or a dispositional finding of abuse. And the decision on whether or not to move a family into the alternate track where there's no finding that will be entered is made at the screening level. So it's critically important that we have the right families going in the right track when they come in and move out of our screening into investigation. So again, the concept of centralized screening, the department's raising that and asking for people to look at that to determine if really that would be, that would be the best way to gain that efficiency. So what we need to do is a feasibility study about what are the pros and cons of a centralized screening program. We did have an ask in the requested budget for 15-17 that didn't get approved for some resources to do that. At this point, this is important enough to the department that we are shifting resources to do that feasibility study and look at other states, what have their successes and their challenges been. And really important, what would the statewide model look like? What are the budgetary considerations? And how do we engage local communities in the conversation around whether or not we should move to this structure? I think you'll find that communities like having their own hotline. And we've done some condensing of them. We used to have even more hotlines. Now the hotlines are condensed down to serving districts rather than individual counties. But there's a relationship that develops between the staff on our hotlines, our screeners, our law enforcement partners, community members, mandatory reporters, that sometimes communities really are loath to let go of. And we understand that, and so we think that we have to be very thoughtful around if we're going to move to this sort of structure, how we do that and retain communities' faith in our screening structure. So Stacy's really going to talk to how we screen, what are the different outcomes of our screening mean functionally for a family, what calls do we not write down and what calls do we write down, document, and how do we move forward from there into our investigations.
Thank you. Ready to go? For the record, my name is Stacy Ayers. Whenever I'm in court, I would always spell my last name, so I'm always wanting to do that, A-Y-E-R-S. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I am here today to talk a little bit about the screening process. I want to talk about the CERT process as well and kind of go into a little bit of some of the lessons learned over the last several years that I've been in my position. I'm in central office as the child safety manager. Formerly, I was the child protective services program manager. And really what that means is I had responsibility over all things related to policies and rules specific to child abuse investigations. And as the department began moving toward a model of safety, what we call safety throughout the life of a case, really what we were talking about is the Oregon safety model. And that has become our practice model. So you'll hear me referring to that as I go through my presentation today. We're talking about Oregon's practice model or the Oregon safety model. They're one and the same. Let me get to my... So I want to talk a little bit about the screening process. And essentially, Lois has described to you that we have multiple hotlines throughout the state. And those hotlines essentially are the where all reports are received. I've heard a little bit of a conversation from Director Cervantes talking about the screening process for OWAPI investigations. It starts at child welfare hotlines that are in the different districts throughout the state. We all essentially are operating off, even at OWAPI, operating off the same statutory scheme, which is 419B005. And so all the definitions of child abuse are located in that particular part of the statute. And it really kind of outlines everything from assaults, which we consider physical abuse, to sex abuse and all the different forms that that may take place in, to negligent treatment of a child, to mental injury of a child. And it struck me as I was listening to some of the conversation that was occurring about willful infliction of pain. Really, when you look at the definition of mental injury in the child abuse code, it really is, it talks about cruelty to a child. And that's really where we would be looking if we were doing an investigation or if we were receiving a report about somebody who was willfully inflicting pain on a child. That's what we would consider it, mental injury. So I'll go to, as these reports come in, screeners are taking this information and through a process called screening, they are gathering information from the reporter, whoever that may be. It doesn't matter if the person's anonymous or they're a mandatory reporter. They're trying to gather as much information as they can about why the person is calling, what the allegation is, how do they know that this occurred, and then essentially they're going to be asking probing questions. They're going to be asking questions to elicit responses. Some people who make reports are very skilled at making reports and may have done it on many occasions, and some are not. And so gathering that information or trying to gather information at times can be a difficult process. In the end, what the screener is doing is making a determination of, is the report, is the information that I'm receiving today, is it an allegation of child abuse or neglect? And if it is, the determination about whether it gets assigned is based on things like, is it a legal parent? Is it somebody who has access to the child, whoever the perpetrator is? Is it a foster home? Is it a department-certified foster home? If it isn't an allegation of child abuse or neglect, it gets put into a category that we call a close-it screening, and those are reports that essentially they are not allegations of child abuse or neglect, but may present a risk to a child. So, by the statutory definition, negligent treatment, threatened harm, physical abuse, sex abuse, it doesn't fit into those criteria, but it could be a risk to a child.
So, Stacy, how does that get communicated to the public or a reporter that makes a mandatory reporter, not a newspaper reporter?
Sure.
That calls in what they believe to be abuse, mistreatment of a child, lack of right. safety for a child. They go through the process. The screener understands it doesn't meet that statutory definition, and they tell the person it's going to be closed at screening.
Right.
I think the member of the public hears that as what's happening to the kid isn't a problem, or we don't care. I think an example of that, I talked to a constituent who had four children, one of whom the father was convicted of sexually abusing. Mm-hmm. After the dad went to jail, the other children began disclosing. So the doctor, the therapist, the parent all made reports. The reports were closed at screening because the dad was in jail, so no longer presented a threat to the children. But that perception of that family when the family came was, why doesn't DHS care that my ex-husband sexually abused the kids? Why would they close this at screening? And she needed that founded disposition in order to do, had to do with the custody and the ability for that father to actually hold photos in his cell of those kids. So is there a way to improve that language or that phrasing?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, that's an excellent question. I guess the premise of the question is that this person who has done these bad acts is now incarcerated, and therefore it's a closed screening. So I go back and I would say, if that is a case that happened, I would want to know about it, because that should not be closed at screening because it fits the criteria for assignment. If this is the father to the children, the fact that he's incarcerated now and may not have access to the children doesn't mean that he won't get out of prison and have access to them at a later time. That's why we investigate those allegations. The types of allegations, well, I'll finish up my Can communication be better? Can we, can screeners, people taking these calls, can they communicate better with people who are making reports? Absolutely. And I think, I don't know if it was Vice Chair Olson, I think it may have been you who was talking about striving for perfection. And I think that we know that there are always going to be certain struggles that come up, but our goal is that we are responding and we are having appropriate reactions, and that our rules are not the barriers to the work that we do, and that communication isn't the barrier to the work that we do. And so we're always trying to be better at how we communicate with the public, whether it's a mandatory reporter or mom calling in saying, I'm trying to protect my kids. And one of the only ways I'm going to be able to do that is if I get a custody order that says he can't have access to my children, whether it's pictures or later when he gets out of prison. So,
Chair Gelsel, members of the committee, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Stacy, a call that would more appropriately be screened is someone who was calling in because their child was beat up by another child or even an adult that lives down the street. Because that's an out-of-home abuse. You have a protective parent. We would not investigate that. We would close it at screening. But there's a mandatory cross-report to law enforcement. So right. Both these scenarios would be mandatorily reported to law enforcement, but one is an in-home and the other is an out-of-home with protective parent.
Can I ask a quick question about that? With that mandatory cross-report to law enforcement, given that you've got these 15 hotlines and you have a lot of independent law enforcement agencies, when do you believe that all law enforcement agencies or the person that's sitting at the fax machine to receive those reports understands this may not fit the criteria for a child abuse investigation, but it may rise to the level of a law enforcement allegation, or do you think some of them go to the file because they come with that closed at screening?
Right. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, just to be clear, when we send over cross reports on the face sheet, there's a language in there that this may be criminal, right? So there's a requirement to put information in there about the fact that we are not investigating this should not be something that you draw conclusions about regarding your own investigation. And then I kind of want to get a little bit more, I don't want to go into too much of in the weeds, but to what Lois was saying about the what we call these are third-party abuse allegations. And so we would assign a third-party abuse allegation if we believed, based on the report that we were receiving, that there was ongoing access and that the parents were not protective. We're not demonstrating. Generally speaking, we're going to get these reports maybe from law enforcement who's already been called out about a situation of a third-party abuse situation, a crime that's occurred, whether it's a physical assault or a rape case. Oftentimes, it'll be a stranger situation, a rape of a child that the families they didn't know, right? So somehow there was this access, but the way that the family is responding to this, they called police as soon as they found out or as soon as it happened. They were totally cooperative with the investigation. We get that cross report from law enforcement, and it's being addressed, okay. Right? So hopefully that provides some clarity about that specific issue. But I think that the cross reporting piece is really critical, and back several years ago, before I was down here, which was in 2008, and there were some cases where cross-reporting was an issue, and there was a work group that was developed and it included law enforcement from multiple jurisdictions and the department to look at the cross-reporting process and put in place certain things so that you wouldn't have people coming to or law enforcement coming to a conclusion that, well, since they're closing it, it's probably not that bad.
Okay. I'm going to go back to what you were alluding to regarding other kids in the family that all of a sudden they started talking about the abuse that they had. And I want to understand through the system, when a child has a lot of services available to them if they have been subject to abuse. And so it's a monetary issue, too. And I'm wondering where it is that there's some reasons why some cases aren't focused on because it doesn't reach a level, just because there's a fear that if we open up the system, it's going to cost the system a whole lot of money, because every child is should be able to access the services if they are abused. Does that enter in?
Chair Gelser, Senator Montes-Anderson, it's an interesting conversation, I would say, because the child welfare system isn't designed nor funded to meet all children's mental health and physical health and emotional health needs. We have some services specific to families that enter the child welfare system, but it isn't for all families. So I think we don't screen, he's my expert, we don't screen cases in to provide services. We screen them in because there's an issue of child safety. And that's the threshold we use for people involved with us. I think there's other systems out there in our communities that have services for families that are similar to what we have as well. But it's the ability of parents to meet their children's needs and keep them safe that we really focus on. And if parents can meet their children's needs and keep them safe and they need services, we probably wouldn't have that family in our system, our child welfare system.
We'll stop asking questions.
No, feel free to answer.
It's a topic,
and we don't want to skip 7:41. We've got one more topic on the agenda too. So
okay, so we talked a little bit about closure screening reports. We talked about it's an allegation of child abuse according to statute, and our rule. There was some conversation earlier about our rules, our child abuse rules. We don't really have child abuse rules. We screen according to what the statute says. So the statute says child abuse is defined as assault, sex abuse, mental injury, negligent treatment, those kinds of things. That's our screening criteria. That's the only rule we follow when we're screening. Now, we may get into the assessment portion when we're looking at dispositions, and we may say, okay, so this came in as a negligent treatment of a child, but it was really about, somebody who didn't get their child immunized, right? However this report came in, but what we find out is it's really about parents not getting their children immunized. Well,
we like to talk about that.
despite what you may think and despite people's personal beliefs about it, the department hasn't characterized that as neglect or child abuse. And there are a number of other places that are similar to that. And so we have rules about dispositions, right? So we talk about what can be assigned, but pursuant to statute, we talk about what can be founded pursuant to different nuances of the law, because there are lots of parts of the child abuse statute that say things like including but not limited to, and it really doesn't provide kind of that clarity. And so the rule piece is to provide clarity about not having it be so expansive that includes everything, but having it be reasonable. And it's the reasonable person standard, I think, that you want people to understand that this is child abuse and this is not. I'm going to go ahead and move on to some of the parts of our screening process that I think people may not know about, is that we don't document every report that comes in. And there are some reports that are what we used to call their information-only reports or logged reports. And in, I believe it was in 2007, and the department was in similar to this one in front of, I believe at that time it was the Judiciary Committee or Subcommittee or Committee, I believe, and we were having conversations about what the department documents, what they keep in their information system. One of those things was turned into a discussion about log calls, and I think there were some concern about log calls, which were not allegations of child abuse and were not reports that could present a risk to a child. Therefore, why would we have them documented in our system? So that was one of the things that, as an agency, we went back and began looking at this process, and we developed a work group, and we essentially removed it as a possibility in our system. So when people are making reports that aren't a risk to a child, they're not allegations of child abuse or neglect, they fit within that logged call process that we no longer document. Okay?
Yeah.
No. Okay. So I will go ahead and...
And for some reason, you have lines instead of words.
I don't have anything because I don't have a PowerPoint up
there.
Oh,
okay. There was one, and then it disappeared. Yeah, so that's good. Good to know.
It's non-informative.
Okay.
All right. So I want to talk about the screening process as it relates to assignments. So we have those reports where it's an allegation of child abuse or neglect by statute, and it is it's a legal parent. Or it's a department-certified foster home, or the perpetrator has access. So those reports, they get assigned for what's called a Child Protective Services assessment, a CPS assessment. And they get assigned in a response time. There are two different response times. One is within 24 hours or immediate response. Call may come in at, 10 o'clock at night, may go to the hotline, one of the hotlines that's staffed, and maybe it will be responded to right then, depending upon the circumstances, what's reported, and maybe it will be responded to first thing in the morning the following day. There's another response time that's within 5 days, and that is the way that I kind of describe a within 5 day response is the times that is appropriate is really when it is you cannot describe how moving or changing that response time it will not compromise child safety essentially. So you have to be able to if you can't justify that, if you can't say, look, if I'm going to push this out to 3 days and I know that it's not going to have an effect on the child safety, then you can't assign it as a 5 day response or an up to 5 day response. And I also want to be clear that an up to 5 day response is just that. It doesn't mean you wait till the fifth day and you go out on the fifth day. It means you have time to do some planning, to figure out where people are, to confirm that the perpetrator is in jail, because that's often the cases that we're talking about. It's the perpetrator's already been arrested. We're finding out about it because law enforcement's been to the home already and arrested the person. So you have those cases, so you have the immediate response, you have the within 5 day response, and as you all know, in Oregon, we are implementing a differential response approach to child welfare. So essentially, how differential response impacts the CPS assessment phase is, or the response phase, is that you have screening process that will do all the same things. They'll look at the allegation, type, assignment, and then they will make a decision about whether the report should be assigned as a traditional response or as an alternative response. And I'll get into that a little bit more, but the traditional response, or generally speaking, those are the reports that we receive that we are wanting to capture a disposition. So Lois referred to this other category, the alternative response cases, where we're looking at those. Oftentimes they're neglect allegations, which doesn't lessen the severity of neglect, because neglect is one of the most impactful types of abuse there is. But it just says that oftentimes the way that I've looked at this is that oftentimes neglect is associated with poverty. And I think we have to be really careful about pinning to somebody a founded disposition against them when maybe what is going on is more related to poverty. And so we can still offer the same type of assessment that we would for a traditional response. The difference would be that we're not indicating that this person is a perpetrator and this person is not a perpetrator. Does that make sense? Okay. So in each of those two categories, traditional response, alternative response, you have the same capacity to be able to assign them as an immediate response or as an up to 5 day. And the biggest determining factors about up to 5 day or the making the difference, making a decision about assigning one as an immediate response is going to be, is there an indication that that child's in danger now? We just got a report that this child, 3 years old, is wandering down the street right now and may have just come into contact with law enforcement or neighbors or people are trying to get them out of the road, right? That's the kind of thing that would require a response right now. So any questions about that before I move on? Really quickly about the abuse investigation piece, I just want to be really clear that as we talk about DR, I think at times people can be concerned that we are talking about a different level of assessment for families that are in alternative response track, and that is not the case. We are doing safety assessments on every family. If the allegation reaches that threshold where it is considered a child abuse allegation, it will require a safety assessment that does not change depending upon which track you're in.
So when you talk about the tracks, I was contacted by a CASA who was raising a concern that a report goes into the screener and the screener puts the case on a track. Yeah. And if the track goes on to the DR track, which is more of a voluntary services track, and the voluntary services don't work out, you can't then retroactively flip it over to where there might be a substantiation. And her concern was that if there was an error in assigning that to the DR track, that you've taken those cases which where it's already been identified there's going to be services, so you already know the child isn't safe, and put them into a place where you've lost kind of the hammer to make sure that it works without the tool to switch it over with a hammer.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, what I would I think we can address that pretty quickly. If our assessment on an alternative response track case, our assessment determines that a child is unsafe, it becomes it is not a voluntary service at that point. Our intervention is required. It's mandated, in fact. And so we don't just get to walk away if the person says, I don't really want you here. I don't want to do services. That if we've determined through our assessment that the child is unsafe, then our determination is also that there's a requirement that services or our intervention is required.
Okay.
So we talk a lot about dispositions, but I just want to make sure that the committee understands that our model, our practice model, is really about overall functioning of a family, and it's almost less about did the incident happen. I'm not trying to say that we are not going to be looking at whether the incident happened, but that's only a component of whether or not a child was safe. It is not the sole determining factor. So we look at kind of really the functioning of a family. That's really what our model is designed to do when we're assessing them. And it really doesn't stop if we've determined that a child is unsafe. It doesn't stop at the assessment. So we then open a case. We then move it on to an ongoing type worker, permanency worker. And those kinds of assessments are continuing throughout the life of a case, either until the safety threats that we've identified have been managed or mitigated to a point where they're no longer there, or that we have we've increased a parent their protective capacities. We call them diminished protective capacities. We've increased them by whatever service provision or safety service providers that we've got involved in a family to a point where they've been able to manage that threat and we don't need to be involved anymore. Okay. So let's talk about the, I think that is the, you want to say something else?
So if we go from there to, I think the agenda said lessons learned and look future looking, and under that category comes the critical incident reviews. This is a statutory review, the primary purpose of which is to pretty quickly draw lessons for the improvement of agency actions when there's an incident, serious injury, or fatality of a child to as a result of abuse and neglect that the department's had contact with in the past year. And the CERT, we call them CERTs for short, the CERTs are a process that identifies systemic issues that we should address and use to improve our system as a whole, either through our practices or our policies. It's not designed to look at the individual that injured the child or killed the child, but to look at how the department interacted in its past history, and is there something we could use out of that to improve the system. So since 2010, there's been 16 critical incident review teams, and I'm not going to try and get this PowerPoint back. You all have it, and I'm technologically challenged. the teams we pull together for the CERT teams are are multidisciplinary teams. And we will frequently have law enforcement, district attorneys. We've had psychologists, treatment providers. It just depends upon the circumstance of the child's death or injury that we create this team. All the CERT reports are posted online. You can go in and read them. And in there, you'll see that we identify corrective actions when we find systemic issues. And so I'm going to have Stacy speak to the larger corrective actions that we – okay, thank you. The more encompassing corrective actions we've undertaken as a part of the CERT process.
Okay, so I'm not going to be able to see it as I'm reading through what I've got written down in my notes. So since I think we're looking at CERTs starting about 2010, kind of moving forward from there, the department has, and I can't remember if it's 16 CERTs since 16. Then. And there have been a couple where we've looked at them and said, you know, we don't feel like there are corrective actions necessary. We feel like things were done appropriately here. We don't feel like there's a systemic issue here, those kinds of things. For the most part, when we go in and look at these, it really starts with a review of the entire case. So we, you know, I've actually done this myself I was recently back in the field managing a branch in Portland and was asked to do a file review on one of the certs. And so I got to see what I'm telling my consultants to do. I got to experience the work of going into a case that's fairly large and really kind of breaking it down and kind of looking at different elements of the case and whether or not we followed, you know, rules, whether or not best practices, whether or not there were other systemic issues that may, if they were changed, have an impact on overall child safety. And so I only say that because I think what is critical is that in every one of the CERT or the CERTs that comes through or is declared a CERT by the director, we are going in and looking at these cases and breaking them down and providing recommendations and looking at things like this that I just mentioned. And so going back to 2010, we had ongoing work around the implementation of our Oregon safety model. And we were spending a lot of time developing trainings around our Oregon safety models. I've talked about the assessment and how the assessment really is it's not designed to look solely at whether or not abuse happened. It's also designed, maybe more importantly, to look at global functioning of the family.
And Stacey, I want to apologize because we took you off track with a lot of questions.
Okay.
But we have about 17 minutes left in the hearing, and I want to get to the 7:41 too. So
I will finish up in like right. 5 minutes.
All right. All right. Sounds great.
So without going through everything that we did, I just want to be really clear that the reviews, in many of the reviews, we identified as a systemic issue, the comprehensiveness of assessments. And if you've read the CERT reports, and I trust that you all have, you will see in there that that seems to be kind of a common theme. Around about 2013, I engaged in a conversation with our federal partners at the National Resource Center. They operate a resource center, and it's through the Children's Bureau, and really engaged them to assist the agency in changing or looking at our rules. What are we doing wrong? What can we improve upon? Is there a lack of clarity? Do we need to do different trainings? What is happening that we're missing the mark? That was kind of my conversation with them. And so we, at that point, pulled multiple cases, began looking at them in consult with the National Resource Center. So we had reached out to our federal partners to help us with this process. And began going through our rules, looking at cases where we had children who are identified as being unsafe, but they were able to be maintained in home, looking at children who are in foster care, looking at foster care abuse, and so really kind of breaking down all the elements of our model. And in about 2013, we really started taking on a process of developing trainings, focusing on supervisors, having our consultant base, which is fairly limited, be available to, they would pair up with supervisors. We called it intensive field consultation, where they spent time specifically with supervisors. The intent was to try to develop a level of expertise in our field supervision, our field supervisors, so that they actually had the capacity then to share that with their workers. So looking at things like efficiency, that was we felt like that was a better sell than trying to get every specific worker at the trainings to try to soak it up, try to understand what they needed to be doing differently, to understand the rules and the changes, et cetera. So that was one of those things. Other changes, we fairly regularly are doing screening reviews where we're, and even at the assessment level, when we're where a CERT may have called out a specific issue related to comprehensiveness of the assessment, we're pulling cases, and as we're doing that, we're also looking at the screening process. So was their decision-making good? Was it consistent with rule? Are there things we need to change about it? And oftentimes we'll find things, even though it's already been assigned and the decision-making seemed to be okay about getting the report passed on, there may have been other things that we looked at, like they didn't contact collateral resources. They didn't contact the doctor. They didn't contact the early intervention person, or they did. That was great, or they didn't notify people according to our rules, proper notifications, like to OWAPI, for instance. So those are things that we've all, as we go through, we take note of the different elements that we find that were potentially flawed, and we create processes to go back and address them.
So some of the, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, some of the more significant improvements to our system have been the increased ability to practice our model with fidelity, the Oregon Safety Model. We created a specialized unit of AAGs to provide advice and representation on certification issues. We developed a teen protocol. We defined when we could share confidential information within the department when we have the same family working in different areas. Centralized screening, as we said before, was a recommendation that we've not yet been able to develop. So it's a resource for us from that tragedy, this intensive review for systemic issues has been a resource that's given us the opportunity to really do some improvements. That said, it is an after-the-fact process, not a before-the-fact. So one other slide you have, I'll talk about our quality assurance moving forward. We are working for the federal review that will occur in 2016. They do all states periodically, and it's an intensive case review process. And so we are in the process of training our staff, our consultant staff in central office, some community partners to be able to review a case with fidelity to the federal tool so that we can conduct our own review. It'll be 120 cases. I think it's a quarter, but I'm not positive about the number. It may be 60 a quarter. And have an ongoing, even after the federal review occurs next year, have those resources to do ongoing reviews of cases to seek these trends and sort of alerts around our practice outside of a tragic event occurring. So we'll be coming to you more to talk about that as we progress in that and give you feedback on that. I think that's it, unless you have questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to say we don't have time for questions.
Okay.
Is that okay, everybody? All right. Thank you
thank you very much.
So I'm going to close the section on child abuse screening and then a quick update on the implementation of Senate Bill 741.
Thank you. I'm going to have Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm going to have Kathy Prouty come forward. She's our permanency manager in central office and was responsible for the training and rule changes related to this legislation.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning. For the record, my name is Kathy Prouty, Child Permanency Program Manager for Child Welfare. So with Senate Bill 741, there were separate divisions, separate provisions in the piece of legislation. One key provision went into effect September 1st, and then a couple of the other provisions become effective January 1st. For the September 1st provision, just to remind you, that was the provision that changed the order of preference for adoption, consideration, and identification. So those administrative rule amendments have all been completed. The procedures have been updated, and any necessary forms have been updated. And those did become effective September 1, and I'll talk about the training in just a minute. So for the provisions that become effective January 1st, those rule amendments are completed. They are currently going through the vetting process for review. They will be ready and will be up and operational by January 1st. So for training, a couple of my staff members and myself, we hit the state at the end of July and pretty much throughout the month of August and provided training not just on Senate Bill 741, but all of the legislative changes that impacted our child welfare practice, both state legislation and federal legislation. We had quite a bit come at one time. So we provided training in every district. We went to 22 sites. And so the entire field, workers, management staff, have been trained on 741. And I have 8 consultants that work in my unit that that are in the field on a regular basis, either doing legal assistant staffings or just ongoing permanency consultation, then of course they too have been well trained on what the changes are and how that impacts practice.
So on the training, has that specifically in Southern Oregon, there has been some assertion that the order of adoption preference does not go into effect until January 1st. Has that been clarified to all branches and courts that September 1st current caretaker and biological family go to the committee?
Yes. Chair Gelser, thank you for that question. I should have also said that the OJD and myself did a webinar to judges. So all of the judges have had the opportunity to hear about the changes. I think we were very clear in our training that the order of preference provision became effective September 1st. I have not heard that there is some confusion, but if there is, I can certainly address that confusion.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, member of the committees, members of the committee, I know that Senator Gelser and I had a conversation after this legislation was passed about legislative intent and the hope that the department wasn't rushing families through prior to the implementation date. And we gave a very clear message to the field that if you have a case where you know you have current caretakers and relatives that are interested, it's not appropriate to rush it simply to avoid the deadline, that we want to make the best selection possible. And those would, once the potential was that we would make a bad choice in simply trying to stay the course rather than stepping back and taking another look. So,
and I know your intervention with that helped and that worked out. I think that adoption committee is actually taking place this week.
Mm-hmm. I think that's all we have, unless members of the committee have questions.
Any questions? No? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Child Welfare and DHS. I know there was a lot of prep that went into a long 3 hours for some of you, so thank you all very much. I'll close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 741. Anything else for the good of the order from the committee? Thank you all for being here at 8. And with that, we're adjourned.
Start in the middle of the day, that's your...
And with that, we're adjourned.
Start in the middle of the day, that's your...